Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of The Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
Heartened by their initial success, the desperate and reasonably violent men of the Permanent Assurance battled on. Until, as the sun sets slowly in the west, the outstanding returns on their bold business venture became apparent. Once proud financial giants lay in ruins. Their assets stripped. Their policies in tatters.
To charter an accountant and sail the wide accountancy, to find, explore the funds offshore and skirt the shoals of bankruptcy. It can be manly in insurance. We'll up your premiums semi-annually. It's all tax deductible. We're very incorruptible. We're sailing on the wide accountancy.
And so they sailed off into the ledgers of history. One by one, the financial capitals of the world crumbling under the might of their business acumen. Or so it would have been, if certain modern theories concerning the shape of the world had not proved to be disastrously wrong.
After the hour of one, in this the month of January, in the year of our Lord 2011. Thank you for coming by, making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network. Hi. Sorry. High above the milk packing district here in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon. A home of all good things and stuff. It is Wednesday, and welcome to Day 12. Thank you for coming by. It's 503-505-6964. I'm not even making eye contact with you right now. 503-505-6964. If you would like to get on board with your comments, questions, clarifications, observations, ruminations, ponderings, musings of an ironic nature, or whatever it is you might have. 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It's rick at rickemerson.com. It is rick@rickemerson.com, you can also Skype if you like. Our Skype username is Rick Emerson Show. That is Rick Emerson Show via Skype. And Dawn Taylor can be emailed. That is Dawn, D-A-W-N, at rickemerson.com. And last but not least, the text box open on the website and so forth. Here's what just happened. So I don't know what you were doing. I don't know what preceded the look you just gave me. But A, like 3 minutes before we get ready to go on the air, you did the greatest and most frustrating thing, where you actually warned me that you were about to take the bag of chili cheese Fritos that you were eating and that you were about to dump the remainder into your mouth, just sort of upending them like, I don't know, like some sort of a snacky dump truck, just sort of going into a landfill. And too late did I hear that from you, and I aimed the iPhone, and I was not able to get the phone up, and I wasn't able to get it focused and to hit the button before it was done and the act was over and completed. So that was sad. So that happened right before the show, and then just now, as I was opening my mouth to say, like, hello and howdy and whatever, I look over and you've done two things simultaneously, three things, really, and I don't even know if you're aware of them all. I look over and, A, you've put your headphones on in a way that has created this perfect faux hawk on top of your head. See, now you've just patted it down, so it's not there anymore. Well, it's sort of there. Wait, look. This is awesome. No, it's great. You know what you've got on top of your head right now? Do you know in the Peanuts comic strip how Charlie Brown's sister Sally always had that weird ball of hair right in the middle of her forehead? You've got one of those, but it's directly on top of your head like a troll doll or something.
Nice.
Or almost like, you're like, what's her name? You're like Snooki from Jersey Shore, you've got like a little bit of a, like a poof sort of a thing.
Change.
Okay, wait, now if you just, now it's gone. Well, thank you for ruining something else that was beautiful, Dawn. Well, in any event. So you had that. And then, but I noticed that third, the first thing I did, I looked over at the, just right as the Dream Theater music was starting, and you had this look on your face. It was a look on your face as though you were smelling sewage while at the same time biting into a bracing York peppermint patty. And the only way I could describe it is just sort of a, like that, sort of an inhalation while showing your teeth, but then also smelling something vile or at least puzzling. And then you had, it was like you were going to put your hands on your hips, but instead you curled your hands underneath and put them in your armpits. And it looked like you were squeezing your own armpits with your arms curled under while giving me this expression of baring your teeth and going and squinting.
While I had this poofy faux-hawk thing.
So what is going on over there?
It was just all... Well, I didn't know about the poofy faux-hawk thing. No, it was...
And you were looking directly at me, looking me in the eyes like you were waiting for my assessment, my input on whatever was wrong with your armpits or whatever.
No, it wasn't my armpits. It was that thing. And the ladies will know what I'm talking about. Sometimes when you're wearing a bra, the lower portions of the bra, the part that goes around your torso, sometimes it'll just kind of dig into you a little bit.
Okay.
And you have to kind of reach down and sort of loosen the elastic a little bit and kind of like readjust it. So I basically, with both hands, just kind of went down and kind of, you know, did that kind of a maneuver.
Okay, all right. And you just made the same face again, by the way, when you did it.
There's certain things. You can't help but make certain faces.
Yeah.
Like no woman can keep her mouth closed while she's putting on mascara. And there are certain things, like when you're reaching up and doing things like that, you do this grimacy face. You just can't help it.
I do that, too. I do that when I shave. I've noticed, which is sort of like putting on makeup, where you just, you're doing something with your face, and you get to do the... And you think of stretching your and making your eyes real big, like, for no reason. So, all right. Well, I was just wondering what was going on over there. It was like you just... I don't know. It was like you'd felt something, a horrible shift somewhere inside your sternum. You know, like one of your organs had just gone, and you just moved over, and you were sort of a, ooh, did you hear that? Sort of a look.
No, it was just kind of, you know,
everything
readjusting the
everything fine?
The thingies. Yeah.
Everything's good over there? You're not going to have any weird, no support issues?
Other than the fact that I went 3 days eating brilliantly, and I'm losing weight, and everything is awesome, and then today I forgot to bring my lunch, and so I ended up hitting the snack box again, so now I'm just filled with shame.
I like how, but I don't mean to pile on, but I'm just saying, was there no third option? Was there either eat well or just sit over there in the chair like a koala bear with a fistful of bamboo and just sort of pawing through the box?
Well, no, there really wasn't any other option because I had breakfast at about 9, and I had a nice bowl of oatmeal, and that lasted me, and that was awesome.
Right.
But it's like then I reached that point of being hungry, and if I don't eat something now, we're going to be here until like 3:30.
Is it going to be grumpy, Dawn?
And I will get very grumpy.
Oh, well, that's
And
fun.
Then I have to go over to Cascadia after this and do Ham-Fisted Radio, so I'm not getting home until like 5:30. And it was kind of like, and my only option. It was either that or eat the 2-month-old rotting salmon that Sarah left in the fridge and then give myself ptomaine.
Or whatever's in this bag over here. Whatever's in this weird, like, seal-a-meal thing that's over on the floor of the studio. Or just sucking down a bottle of ketchup from the door of the fridge.
Don't let me forget to take that Christmas present that somebody left here for Court and Fat Boy to Bobby today when I go there. Because we just looked at this box like last week, and I said, there's this still wrapped Christmas present sitting here. What is this? Who is it for? And it says, for Court and Fat Boy. And I was like, oh, well, maybe someone who sees them should take that to them. Because I had no idea it was for them. And so listener Andy If they haven't thanked you for the gift you gave them,
it's because they're rude.
It's because they're unaware it exists.
Yes. All right.
So
well, they are unaware it exists. I mean, it's not like, and clearly Andy hasn't raised the issue yet.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like anybody's said anything about it.
He probably just thinks that they're just horrible people and don't say thank you for nice things.
Be a shame if that were just to stay here. I wonder what it is. Hold on, I'm going to go lift it. I'm going to see if it's heavy.
It's a substantial package. It really is. I have no idea what's in it. It's
wow.
Really big.
Hold on. Let's see if it rattles. No, it's solid, whatever it is.
Yeah.
All right. And it does Kurt und, it says with an umlaut. Kurt und, fat boy, from listener Nick in Utah.
Oh, Nick. I thought it was Andy, but no.
No, it says listener Nick in Utah. But it wasn't mailed. How did this get here?
I have no idea.
It arrived.
Showed up. Well, there are a bunch of things showed up. I think somebody brought it when they brought something for Sarah and Greg.
Ah, okay, I see. So it was part of a whole bunch of things that were dropped off.
Yeah.
I wonder how it somehow got from Utah to here. All right. Well, I'll put this over here by the door so you don't forget about it. Hold on a second. Wait.
Thank you very much.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program brought to you today by EH Vending, providers of Dawn's Lunch today and every day. Wait, by the way, when we got that box from EH Vending, I mean, it was like half full. I mean, it was entirely full.
It was pretty well full.
For people who want to know exactly how large this box is, I would say if you took the average surface area of your average TV tray and then increased it by about 30%, that's the size of the box we're talking about. I would say that the box
is the large sized flat rate shipping box.
Oh, is that what that stands for?
From the
flat
box.
Rate?
Yeah.
So I would imagine the box is 2.5 feet tall. Probably about a foot and a half across, and maybe about 6 inches wide. I mean, that's a lot. It's like you had the world's largest board game. Basically, it was about half full of snacks. How full would you say it is now?
Oh, maybe a quarter full. And I'd say it was probably a good 2/3 to 3/4 full when we got it. It was pretty darn full.
The best thing was watching you sort of triage through all of the snacks between Legion of News and this show, trying to figure out exactly what it was. Like, you were sort of looking through, trying to figure out what is going to have the perfect mixture of hunger satisfaction and minimization of your shame.
Yeah.
And you settled on chili cheese Fritos. Was that it? Was you eating anything else?
I had chili cheese Fritos and chocolate chip cookie.
Okay. No Rolos yet?
No, there's still one thing of Rolos. There's still a Snickers bar, which I almost ate the Snickers.
You know, that's packed with peanuts, dog.
That is a premium candy. That is a high-end candy. That's like the holy grail of Halloween candy when you get the fun-sized Snickers bars. And there's a broken-in-half Butterfinger as
really?
Well.
Here's the thing about Butterfinger. Butterfinger always tastes really good until I get about halfway through it, and then it kind of turns on me. Not unlike those pink and white frosted animal cookies. You eat those, and it's like there's a certain point. It's like it goes all vile in your mouth. I don't know what the hell it is. There's some sort of lard kind of something or other in there that just you reach a saturation point really quickly with that.
Most candy has, particularly mass-produced candy, has a pretty long shelf life. But the thing I've noticed with Butterfinger is Butterfinger tastes great if they're relatively fresh.
Yeah.
But when you get a stale Butterfinger, and you often do, because God only knows how long it's been sitting there at the Plaid Pantry before you buy it. And you get it's weird and chewy and unpleasant.
Well, that's because Butterfinger is not solely reliant on the texture, but the texture is a big part of the appeal. It'd be like having like an old squishy gummy baklava. You know, where you just go, like, it's the flakiness is really what sells the flavor of that sometimes.
I thought of you last night, by the way. I was, because I'm on a diet, of course, I was sitting and perusing all of my favorite food websites, particularly the ones that have cookie recipes.
Licking the screen.
Because it becomes like porn when you're, like, dieting. But I found a recipe for peanut butter and jelly rugula.
I don't know how I feel about that. That seems like it might be good. I don't know.
Yeah.
Peanut butter is like such a magical ingredient. You can make any snack food better if you add peanut butter to it.
It had never occurred, because arugula is essentially, you know, a jammy filling in the middle of this delicious flaky pastry. So it's essentially that plus peanut butter. And I thought, that never occurred to me before. That sounds really, really good.
I wonder if I should try. I wonder if arugula is difficult to make.
Not really.
All right.
Particularly if you don't make your own. If you don't make your own pastry, you can just go buy Danish pastry dough frozen, at the supermarket and then just cut it into bits and do it yourself.
You know, Lara's always looking. This is the great thing about my wife is that she, as late in life, has discovered the joy of, you know, the joy of cooking and preparing her own foods or whatever. So she's always looking for new stuff to make. And so it's not like I'm telling her to do it as like, you know, it's like it really is like she wants me to find and assign her new things to try making in the kitchen, which I don't really do all that often because I'm a creature of habit. So I just eat the same five things all the time. But every now and again, if I discover something, if I see something, I'm like, hey, you should try your hand at making this. And then she will. And, you know, sometimes it turns out great, sometimes not. But that's a thing that I could, because she wants to learn how to make more desserts. Because I think, here's the thing, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but I think like many women, maybe less than, this probably doesn't happen as often as it used to, but I think like let's say a fair number of women, I think to some degree, I won't say that she measures herself against my mother or lives in the shadow of my mother in any way, because I think she's, you know, she, as Beyonce would say, she's an independent lady. But you know, she grew up in a household where everything just came out of a can, or everything just came from, like, you know, everything came from Shopko or whatever. Everything was just like saran wrapped and nothing was ever, you know, homemade. You know, but she knows that I came from a family where everything was the opposite, where my mom made everything, especially desserts. I mean, I never had, like, anything that came out of a package. Every dessert that I ever had growing up was made, you know, my mom made it. And she's had, you know, we were just in Kennewick a few weeks ago, my mom was doing that. And my mom really is one of those women who has, like, she has no awareness of how great it is, you know, that she can just make stuff. Like, she can just whip, you know, she can just whip stuff up, like, no, you know, just with you know, just by with waving her hand. So she just, like, made some, like, apple crisp or something on a Sunday morning, and it was, like, golden and warm and flaky with, like, a dollop of whipped cream or something on top. And, you know, Lara did that thing of getting one spoonful in and going, oh, my God, this is the best thing I've ever had. And so she's really aware that there's a chasm in her cooking knowledge, so she's always looking for new desserts to make. So maybe the arugula, throw that out and see if she can do it as sort of a home cooking challenge. Awesome.
Patrick made dinner last night, and he doesn't usually, he cooks with me, because when I first met him, he didn't really know how to make anything.
Right.
And now he knows how to do some things, but it's mostly, we mostly cook together. And I've told him, you know, I said, honey, you know how to cook now. You could just get recipes or what have you and make something all on your own without any help. You could do that. He's like, maybe I should. And last night he decided, we had this, we've been going, we're poor. So we've been, like, doing that thing that you get to sometimes towards the end of a pay period where we're digging through the freezer going, what's this? Maybe we could make something with that. It's been here for months.
Is it like Apollo 13 where you put all the things on the table and you go, what can we make out of this?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
And one of the things we had I shop at the wholesale grocery a lot for, like, you know, just weird ends of meat and giant packages of cheese and
yak
like
ankles.
That. And I bought this. It was a pound of like mixed seafood, which was really super super cheap. And it was like little bits of calamari and some scallops and some tiny shrimp and some stuff. And it was just and it was all just like a big frozen bag of the stuff. But it was really cheap. It was like $2 for a pound of this.
Is this where they're just hosing the deck of the boat off into a bag?
I think probably, yeah.
Okay.
So, and it was in the freezer. And so I had kept saying, what can we do with this? And I'm like, I don't know. Make a soup. I don't know. Stew something. And I had said at one point, I said, well, you know, we could make curry. You could make a curry with it. So last night he was going, if I wanted to make curry, what would I do? And he's like standing there and he's holding like a can of coconut milk in his hand. And I said, well, you put the coconut milk in a pan and you heat it up and then stick some of the red curry paste in it. And he goes, how much? I go, I don't know, a big spoonful, taste it and then until it tastes good. And then get it nice and hot, like bring it up to a simmer and then dump the seafood in it and just cook it really fast so it doesn't get gummy. And he's like, okay. And the next thing I know, he's got like a bowl and he cooked some orzo and he put orzo in a bowl and he poured this curry over it, and it's like he did it basically all by himself.
I don't even know what orzo is.
Orzo is a pasta that's, if you've ever seen it, it looks kind of like big grains of rice.
Oh yeah, okay, I have seen that. All right.
So and I always have orzo because we bought like a six pound box of it once, and so we've had orzo for like 3 years.
The same
or
reason
something.
We have like lentils, you know, in like every third meal, because she bought like a 7,000-pound bag of lentils. That and like coconut powder.
Yeah, I understand she's still trying to get rid of that coconut flour that she bought like 2 years
she
ago.
She had it in her head somehow that she was going to be able to, that it was like an Amway thing. She was going to be able to like deal coconut powder to her hippie friends. She's like, no. I'm like, baby, why do you need 75 pounds of coconut powder? She's like, no. She's like, I can put it into smaller. It's like when your friend tells you to, you know, buy a quarter, but then you sell an eighth or something. So she's like, no, I can put it into smaller bags and I can sell it to my friends. I'm like, okay, not going to happen. And it's sure enough, it's just sitting in a pantry somewhere. So,
but it was great. And Patrick, it really tasted good. It was really, he did a fine job with it. But we were eating dinner, like, but of course, about five or six times throughout the night, every once in a while, apropos of nothing, Patrick would just say, I made dinner. And I'd say, yes, you did, honey. It was very, it was good, too. Yes, it was. It was
like,
really good.
It's like when a boy learns to put on long pants for the first time. Well done. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Coming up today, we got your Clown Watch, Taser Watch, Penis Watch coming out today, Geek Watch, actually, I think leftover from yesterday. I believe Kelly Clark from Willamette Week is going to join us sometime this hour, although, to be fair, I have not yet confirmed that, so I'm working on a confirmation of that. I think we'll be talking to Kelly Clark from Willamette Week. Don't forget, today's Rick Emerson Radio Program brought to you by EH Vending. EHVending.com is where you can find out more about them for all your vending needs. If you have a business or your current vending provider is just, well, a jackass, you can talk to Josh or James at EH Vending, and you can have them take over your vending service or establish vending service at your business. Speaking of that, we should say that, so yesterday, this is what happens without adult supervision.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, we're doing this revised version of Name That Snack, where we give out now one question every day, and then on Friday, as we give out the fifth question, then whoever gets us the answers to all five questions, you know, so we'll give out one on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then on Friday, when we give out the fifth question for the week, we then say, all right, the first person to email, you know, the correct answers to all five questions to snack@rickemerson.com, you'll win a big bag of stuff, a big gift basket from EH Vending. We're all yesterday, though, I swear to God, and it's like I had the music and everything playing underneath, the little Archie's bed and whatever, and I said, oh, by the way, they made this fantastic peanut butter wafer chocolate bar from Mrs. Freshley's. And we got into like some 19-minute conversation about that, and then at the end of it, we had not given out the question, but neither of us remembered or realized that, and we just went, okay, to the top five we go. And I looked back, of course, later at the screen, and Cheryl was just going like, question, 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 ask the question in all caps, and we didn't realize it, so we went all day yesterday, never asked the question.
No.
So today is just going to be a four-question week. Today we'll give out question number two, which should have been yesterday. So we'll clarify this each day through Friday so that people don't get confused. But it's just going to be a four-question week. We will just skip yesterday altogether. Yeah. We'll give out question number two today. So that'll be coming up later on in the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
And then when we have a moment, I have two things to share. So
About
just completely wildly different things. One from an email from a listener and another a personal thing.
Well, let's do that right after you say what headlines we're tracking for the people on this Wednesday.
Well, Howard Stern has signed a contract to continue his morning show. Scientists have discovered that fish can count up to three. And Alabama's new governor says that only Christians are his brothers and sisters.
Okay, then. What is item the first that you have to...
Item on the first is an email from a listener who pointed out that there was indeed an episode of House where the diagnosis was scurvy.
Really?
Yes.
I don't know why I didn't remember that.
It was the first season, the first episode of the third season, and there was a woman named Karen who was paralyzed with no sign of trauma to her limbs or spine. House thought she was faking it and threatened to stick a huge needle in her chest. Then he did it, then found blood was building up around her heart. Then he was going to open her up to find the tumor that he was sure she must have. And it turned out that she had scurvy.
Oh, well,
and they gave her orange juice.
I am corrected then.
So there you go.
Thank you, sir.
And the other thing I wanted to mention was I was cleaning my office last night and I found this envelope. I've been holding on to this for several years.
It's a big manila envelope.
The background on this is... apparently, I discovered later, there was in 1999 another woman named Dawn Taylor living in Portland. And I believe she worked in some capacity as like a volunteer coordinator for a political faction of some sort. Because in the mail back in September of 1999, I got a letter from the United States Senate that to Miss Dawn Taylor said, Dawn, I hope all is going well. Thank you for all your hard work and dedication. We wish you happiness, health, and prosperity for the future. Enclosed is an autographed picture of you and the senator. And enclosed is an autographed picture of Gordon Smith and not me.
That's weird. That's really bizarre.
So the best I was able to figure, because I Googled this woman and found that there was this other woman in Portland, and I'm guessing Justin Gottlieb, who was one of Smith's helpers, in Washington, D.C., must have just gone to the phone book
right.
and gotten an address for a Don Taylor and sent me this autographed photo from Gordon Smith to Don with appreciation and affection.
To some smiling, suburban-looking blonde woman.
Yeah, who is not me.
Wow. I wonder if she grew embittered over the many months that her her volunteerism was never acknowledged, that they never
Gordon
sent
Smith doesn't appreciate me.
Not so much as a signed photograph. I wonder if maybe it wrecked her life in some way or changed her party affiliation, or she began working for the other side with all kinds of zealotry because of this.
I know. I thought that I should maybe, find her and give it to her, and then I just said, nah. And I've always meant to get one of those double-sided framed, those frames where you frame documents and photos side by side and just frame this and have it hanging in my house.
I got two things. One is we should find her and then just go to her house and deliver it. It'd be like one of those wacky Dear Abby things where, a guy delivers a letter from Guadalcanal and it shows up, in his hometown in, 2004 or something. Baby, we're getting ready for the big push against the Japanese, or something. And, it's delivered, years later. So we should do that. I got two or three things. When you first started saying there's this woman named Don Taylor who was a volunteer or something or other, I was convinced that what you had was an obituary or some sort of a death notice or dear friends and family of Don Taylor, I was saddened to hear of her passing. And then from her priest or her boss or something. And that you would just save an obituary for a woman named Don Taylor. Because that sort of seems like the sort of thing you would do.
Well, about a month before I got this, I had gotten a letter from Gordon Smith's office that said, Don, it was great to meet you. Thanks for everything, Gordon Smith. And I looked at this and I was like, well, that's really weird.
The hell?
And I kind of put it aside, that just confuses me. I don't know what that is. I didn't know what to think of it, so I just put it aside. And then about a month and a half later, I got this photo, and I just went, okay, this is even weirder. And then finally, I said, what?
Did you get anything else for her, or was it just those two items?
No, just those two things.
It makes you wonder how they realized the mistake. Or if they ever did. I mean, did the aide to Gordon Smith look at him and go, oh, damn, I was, when he two Don Taylors in the phone book and his finger was on the wrong one when he typed at the address?
Or she called or something and they said, how'd you like that photo of you? I never got that. I don't know what you're talking about.
Do you ever do this? Do you ever send an email off to somebody and you'll go so far as to check the send items folder, but you just secretly don't believe, you are convinced that it's somehow gone to the wrong person. Or have you ever, you're typing in an email address and it'll start to autocomplete something and you go no, and you delete it and you type in the correct address and you look at it and then you check it again, and then if you're like me, it'll reduce it down to an abbreviation. It'll say Dawn, and then I'll hover, or as my wife would say, hoover my mouse over it until the full email address appears. I've actually gone so far as to make somebody like Sarah or somebody come in and go, Sarah, read this email address out loud, tell me who this is going to, and she'll read the address and go, okay, You're my independent verification that I am not missending this. This is going to the right person. And then somebody says, yeah, and then I'll hit send. Because I live in fear of a thing like that, where I just send the wrong email to the wrong person, and then just some sort of, some sort of shenanigans ensue or whatever. So, I don't know, maybe that's the deal with that.
I've sent texts to the wrong people since I've gotten the iPhone, twice. And I'm not sure how, but it seems to be much easier with this than other phones I've had.
Well, because it's like that thing, Sarah has the new, she's an Android phone. She was she kept hanging up on some guy with her chin. She kept going, so anyway, that's really great. Hello? And then just she would have moved and her cheek will have brushed the phone and it will have done. Well, that thing, I don't know, I forget if you were here or not. It might have been when Snyder was here. We were talking about there's this new glitch in the, there's this glitch they've discovered in Android-based phones. Again, doesn't happen all that often. Very rarely, but I mean, how many times do you really want this to happen? Where occasionally, if you are sending a text message, regardless of who the recipient is or whether you have typed the correct recipient in the sort of, the to field, it will just arbitrarily send it to somebody else that is in your address book. And there's no way to know unless you go in and check the sent items folder. There's no indication.
Aaron Duran was saying that happened to him with his phone.
I mean, and it doesn't ever tell you. It doesn't say, you don't see it change to the wrong recipient. It's I'll say, send something to Don. And it would say, okay, sending to Don. But then it goes to Greg Nibbler or whatever, or anybody else in the address book. And there's no way to know until either A, you check your sent items, which when do you ever do that? Never. or B, you know, when, like, your husband comes home and he wants to know who, like, you know, who Terrence is, you know, and then there's just, and then there's a long, awkward conversation that ensues. So it's all very weird.
Also, I have an email from someone about where to buy the Mrs. Freshley's products, and I could mention that later.
I almost don't want to know. You should save that.
I will save that till later.
Ask me later if I really want to know, because I may not want to have access to that information. All right. Was that, did you have anything else?
I got nothing. That's all my business.
All right. We should talk about, I don't know. We should get the news here in just a second. Again, I'm unclear about whether we're going to be joined by Kelly Clark today. We may or may not, but we got the top five coming up later on the day. Top five classic bubblegum songs of all time. And that is because of the passing of Mr. Don Kirshner yesterday, the day before. So we're going to do the top five classic bubblegum songs, Clown Watch, Taser Watch, Penis Watch, Geek Watch, so forth. Plus, we'll have, question number two for version number two for what we used to call Name That Snack. So that's coming up as well. It's 503-505-6964. But, by the way, just apropos of nothing, somebody mentioned to me this morning, the listeners occasionally would do this thing where they would get so fed up with my forgetfulness and me putting things off or just opening my mouth to say something like, oh, I don't know, the question for a contest where you could win some stuff, and then not doing it, that I will occasionally wake up and I will go to my inbox or my whatever, and there will just be messages waiting for me from listeners where it's like an electronic note pinned to my virtual sleeve, where they are reminding me, like, don't forget, Rick, you were going to do that thing today. Sort of like when your wife or your mom or somebody would just say, like, don't forget, you know, take a brush to school. It's picture day. You know, and because I will never remember. So a listener prompted me this morning. He said, don't forget, you were going to tell us exactly why you were doing vehicular, in quotes, work this weekend, why you were working in your car. I guess it's less interesting now. I mean, now that a few days have passed. But I will just say, It's not so much interesting as it is just another illustration of how I'm less than a man in every conceivable way. I finally, and this is the sort of thing that will impress nobody. No illusions that I was actually doing anything that required actual, like, masculinity or brains or brawn or anything. I was all impressed with myself this weekend because I managed to. Do you remember? I think I've told the story when we were getting ready to launch this show back in June. Thomas Gill was in town, and we were driving around. And I was lamenting the fact that my BlackBerry kept going dead because I didn't have a car charger that worked. And he said, well, it's probably not the car charger. You know, it's probably not the cord or the cable itself. He said, it's probably the 12-volt socket. It's probably the cigarette lighter in your car. And I said, huh? What do you mean? And, of course, I immediately leaped to, do I have to return the car? You know, it's just like, that is my solution to everything, right? It's like, I am the guy that they love to see coming at the dealership because I have no idea how to fix anything at all. So I will take it back and I go, the cigarette lighter doesn't seem to work. Charge me whatever you think is fair. And then I just, you know, here's a blank check. And then I go away and I come back an hour later and they, you know, that'll be $4,000. And they've just replaced the entire thing. I have no idea how to fix anything in my car at all. And before somebody asks the question, no, I cannot change my own oil. Never could, never have. Don't know how to. I can barely add oil to the car. I mean, I have nothing. But, of course, you know, so Thomas is all like, well, you know, there's a whole series of fuses, you know, that, which to me is just like saying that the internet is a series of tubes. I mean, maybe it's true, maybe it's not, but even if it was, I don't know where they are. I don't know how to fix the tubes or to access them in any way. I have nothing. Do you know where the fuses are in your car?
In this particular car, no, but I know how to find out.
Yeah, well, you know.
There's a little booklet in the glove compartment of your car.
Owner's manual?
That shows you where the fuses are.
Yeah, I know.
I knew where they were on my previous vehicles, yes.
I didn't... This makes me sound like an idiot, or maybe just illustrates that I am, in fact, an idiot.
I think you just willfully choose to not clutter up your mind with certain things.
You know what it is?
And that's understandable. That's fine. I'm that way about some things.
What are you about that way about?
It's
just like the locations of states?
Often, yeah. There's that. I don't know the capitals of states. I don't know where states are. I've lived in this town for 20 years, and I still don't know where most streets are actually located. And I don't know. I know very little about sewing. I can sew a button on. But it's like if I had to like sit down and use like a sewing machine or something, I would. And I've kind of thought on occasion I would like to be able to put things together and make things from fabric. And then I just think about the whole idea of having to learn how to use a sewing machine and sew things. And I immediately just go, No.
So if I gave you the pattern of the machine and a bolt of fabric, you just go like, no, I got nothing.
You know, I often would like to use spreadsheets. And I know that spreadsheets must be very, very simple and basic to create and use. I know many people who create and use them.
You just don't know how to do it
yourself.
Every
time I sit down with some kind of a spreadsheet program, I will spend a minute and a half trying to figure it out. And then I will just go, nope, too hard.
I give up. Well, I am that way, and we will in a moment be speaking with Kelly Clark. She's on hold there, so we'll be picking up her call in a second. But I will. I am that way about automotive stuff, and I think for me, it's like it is a binary system. It's like if I feel like I cannot, I won't say learn everything, but if I feel like I can't have at least a basic mastery of a subject or a skill, I don't even try. It's like, that's why, this is a dumb example, but that's why I don't play Guitar Hero. Because every single time I've tried to play Guitar Hero, and I would, you know, I spent like over the course of the first year that it came out, it's like I would, every time I had the chance, I would attempt to, you know, I would try to get, you know, get my play on with that. And it was just, and I would just get hosed every time. And I figured out after, you know, like the 12th or 15th time, like, this is a skill I'm really never going to possess. I'm not really ever going to be, not even the best. I'm just not going to be good at this. So if I can't be good at it, I'm not even going to waste my time, because what is the point?
This is why I've never been ice skating.
Right, because it's like, you know, you can't be accomplished at it.
I've never done it. When I was invited, every time I was invited, I realized I don't know how to do this, and everyone will be having fun while I am the person who is dragging myself around the outside of the rink, holding onto the rail.
Snapping your ankles.
Then I will fall down and everyone will laugh at me.
Yep.
So I just go, no, I'm busy that day.
Yeah, and that's me with automotive stuff. I think the second time that my dad went, hey, you want to hand me that 3/16? And I just went, and I would just look at the toolbox, which suddenly seemed like the 2010, you know, the 2001 obelisk, just this huge sort of, you know, I don't know, you know, and I would just, you know, immediately just run in the house and, you know, I don't know, just write poetry. So I don't know anything about cars. This makes me sound like an idiot, or underscores that I have always been an idiot in this regard. Until Thomas Gill actually said that last June, I had no idea your car had fuses. I didn't know. I mean, which sounds stupid, but I mean, I just had no, it never, it'd be like if you told me that the car had camels or something, like, in it. Like, I had no recognition of that fact. And he's like, yeah, there's a fuse box, and you can figure it out, and you can probably, and so our listener, Rick, for Christmas, came by and gave us a couple of iPhone accessories, because he's a charming and wonderful person, very generous, and, again, inexplicably pays for the show, and then also gave us stuff. And I was looking at this, I'm on the trip to Kennewick. I got so frustrated, because I was listening to, you know, wonderful streaming entertainment and music on my iPhone, but I kept having to compulsively check the battery bar, because, like, oh, it's you know, and then at a certain point, I had to turn it off and just whistle to myself, because I was afraid that I would drain the battery by using, you know, by listening to music or whatever, and then I would not have the phone for when the car broke down by the side of the road, and I would not be able to tell anybody that I was being gang raped by the Gypsy Jokers bicycle gang, or motorcycle gang, that the Hell's Angels would come kidnap me, and I wouldn't be able to let anybody know about my plight. So I just turned off the phone. So I finally got sick of that, and I'm like, I'm gonna fix the freaking car charger. I could not find the automotive manual, because it is in a filing cabinet that I had started an incredibly complex and elaborate filing system in. I didn't keep it in the car, of course. That would have been too logical. I put it in a filing system where I keep all of my owner's manuals. Laura wasn't aware that there was anything in the filing cabinet and just gave it away to a friend of hers. So now there's this whole year for which I have no documentation, because it's just, it's like at a St. Vincent de Paul thrift store or something by now. So I went online. Long story short, I found the PDF. Like a nerd, found a PDF of the owner's manual, looked up where the fuse was for the cigarette lighter, and then I had to do the thing of going to the auto parts store near my home. And you walk into the auto parts store if you're me, and you immediately are just in such foreign territory. It's like you know what it is? It's like you're a Muslim youth who's been dropped into a swingers club, where you're just looking around going, I have no idea how I'm supposed to conduct myself or behave in this environment, and I am unnerved in the deepest way because of it. And I find myself doing things like, you know, like kind of hitching my jeans up a little bit and sort of trying to look like I'm, you know, like, you know, surveying the racks of merchandise so I can find the right fuse for the car, wishing that I had grease under my fingernails or like maybe a baseball cap to push back on my head as I'm sort of squinting and comparing various items. And finally, I just took the fuse that I had managed to pull out, that I've managed to pull out with, you know, with like a pair of, like, you know, like a pair of bad pliers that came in, you know, what my wife calls her straight girl's tool set that her dad gave her when she went off to college. Pulled the fuse out, went in, the guy handed it to me, and And then I went home, and if like any of my neighbors saw me, I was just sitting there so terrified that I was going to inadvertently electrocute myself by putting the fuse in, even though I think that's actually impossible.
Yeah, pretty much.
But of course, I don't know that. And so you have never seen, it was like I was leaping around like Tom Hanks after he created the bonfire in Castaway. Seriously, just sort of like, I am king of the world. I am ruler of all creation. The happiest moment, I swear to God, of the last 6 months of my life has been when I plugged in the iPhone charger and the little blue light came on and it worked. I have never felt so accomplished and more like a man of the world than at that moment.
Congratulations, Rick Emerson.
I have no reason for telling the story except that I don't know. It's just because it's probably never going to happen again. I will never again be able to fix anything on the car. And even calling this fixing anything in the car is such an overstatement. But I mean, it was, you know.
I tell you, though, there are those moments that you feel like that. And it is an awesome, awesome feeling. I'm sure our ancestors felt like that when they, you know, brought down a water buffalo or something like that. But with us, it's these small little things. And like in our case, the big giant free TV. And Mike Russell showed me where the plugs were supposed to go in to plug things in. And then we plugged the DVD player in. And I swear to God, I was fully expecting when I turned the thing on,
just smoke to pour out,
that nothing would work. Because my experience with electronics and trying to figure out which component plugs into what where has been that it takes hours of trial and error before I sort of accidentally get things plugged into the right places. And this is, we got in there, we got under there. Pat couldn't figure it out, but I went in and I was like, no, it's got to be this one. And we put him in, turned it on, put the DVD in, and I was like, oh my God, it's working.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it worked like the first time. We did it. Hooray.
And then you realize that thing that I realized when I put the fuse in and the iPhone charger worked. You are so massively impressed with yourself, but in the same instant, you realize that no one else will be impressed at all.
Oh, yeah. You're impressed with yourself over something that somebody like Thomas Gill would just go, really?
Like a five-year-old could accomplish.
Seriously? Really?
Yeah. So that's me. That's my life.
Yeah.
All right. Before we go to the news, we should do this. She's been sitting by patiently while I regaled people with an anecdote that really, in retrospect, isn't all that interesting. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson radio program from Willamette Week arts and culture editor and stylish woman of the world, Ms. Kelly Clark. Hello there.
Well, hi, you two.
How are you on this?
Congratulations on being such accomplished people in the world.
I really am the handiest of men. It's just...
did Don really compare taking down a buffalo to plugging in an iPhone a second ago?
I believe
so. I think
so.
I heard that.
Yeah.
The thing is, for me, it's like there's also... I mean, not only because it's really easy and like a child could do it, but also there's no, like just for me specifically, there's no reason that finding, removing, and replacing a fuse on my car should have been all that difficult because, again, I am not a guy who's, I'm not challenged for the most part by electronic, you know, by electronic accessories or audio video components or hooking up anything in my home computing system or with my wireless network. I mean, I can get, you know, for the most part, I can figure most of that stuff out. And it's like, it's just, I sort of take
it.
Yeah, I mean, I take it for read, as read that I can do it. But the car, I think I have just such a mental block. I think I have built up the car in my head and all things automotive as just being so. Yeah, I am intimidated by cars and car maintenance and car repairs. I will not lie about that at all.
Frankly, my greatest skill is delegating. I pride myself on that. And so I've delegated most of those car maintenance things to other people.
Right, and that's for the...
And I'm proud of myself for that.
Because you are...
And I can pat myself on the back for that.
Whereas your ancestors were hunters and gatherers, you have actually gathered sufficient financial resources and a social circle that you can delegate the hunt to other people.
Well, I mean, I grew up with a dad who works on old cars for fun. He has an old Jag, he has an old Volvo. He put an MG together from scratch. Like, I don't even know, he, like, built the mechanics in order to build it or in order to put it together. So, you know, I was taught these things when I was a kid. Like, I was taught to change a tire. I changed my own brake pads on my car. Like, I can do all that stuff. But it never really stuck the way that, say, learning how to salsa dance did or, you know, other skills that are more applicable than to my daily life.
Like, I was in my bedroom just learning how to air guitar hot for teacher perfectly, you know, while everybody
exactly.
else was. Yeah. Somebody via Skype says that this is really accurate. Describes Dawn and I He says, you guys are like tech midgets or little people. You're never going to get any bigger. So it really is true. It's like, I think I just I lack the ability to retain certain kinds of knowledge. And maybe that's only because I've convinced myself that I can't do it. But it's real nonetheless.
I just kind of feel like there's a finite amount of space in my brain, and that if I put that information in there, I'll have to take something out. And maybe that's the words to We Didn't Start the Fire by Billy Joel, and I just don't want to do that.
By the way, Thomas Gill is noting, he said that we had to learn to change tires while we were in Cub Scouts. So there you go. So he's actually outstripped me.
Oh, that's manly.
But
the great thing about this is that we are also very appreciative people, because if you come across someone with this skill, you think they are awesome.
That's the thing.
For instance, my husband fixed a door in our house. The door, our bathroom door, fell off the hinges while I was using the restroom. I mean, just fell off. Just the door fell off the hinges. And I was like, oh my God, what are we going to do? Are we going to need a new door? How are we going to fix it? Do we need to call the door guy? And my husband calmly fixed it with some wood glue and some dowels.
I like the idea, by the way, that you thought there was a door guy, that you would go to like the Yellow Pages and like, the doors, and there'd be a...
This was a couple years ago when we first moved into our house, and I was just like, who do we call? And Dave's like, I'll fix it. I was like, you'll fix it? And then he did. And that's why I'm still married to him.
So that is
because he fixed the door.
I
can also pee in peace now, so it's great.
It's one of those things where, like, when Gil notes that he learned to do that in Cub Scouts, like that is how long. See, that's so it's not like a recent development. It's like I wandered off the intellectual path early on. I mean, so he has outstripped me in that knowledge department for like the better part of three decades. I took the wrong fork in the road or something at that point.
I think those formative groups might have something to do with it, because my husband was not a Boy Scout. He was actually a Brownie. But either way, I think they teach them this kind of stuff because he's handy too. I was never part of these groups. I don't know. I was in like creative loom, weaving classes and creative arts classes and stuff dance classes.
What do you mean he was a Brownie? Please to explain.
Yeah, that's kind of weird. His mother was the head of a Girl Scout troop, and he had two older sisters, and so they would take him along, and so they just made him a Brownie.
Oh, that's awesome.
And then he was in Boy Scouts, but he never liked it. He's like, there's no girls around. There's nobody to kiss. There's nobody that, there's no... You know, because if he was skillful at something in front of the girls when he was a little boy, they'd make, they'd ooh and ah over him, but like in the Boy Scouts, he's like, it wasn't nearly as fun.
See, so that's...
He proudly refers to himself as a Brownie.
That's one of those things...
He's like, the Boy Scouts, whatever. He's like, he's not proud of it, but Brownie, he's like, those were some great days.
That is one of those things that it's embarrassing, and then one magical morning, it becomes awesome.
The morning that your bathroom door falls off, trust me, it becomes... Awesome.
Excellent. Thank you, by the way, for just sitting by and biding your time while you heard me describe the various ways in which I'm inefficient and incompetent and a boob. Usually there's a we talk a little bit beforehand and kind of get an overview of what's in the new issue, but I really don't know. So I will find out at the same time as everybody else. What's in the new Willamette?
Well, the big thing culturally, obviously, is Portlandia. I'm assuming, I don't know if you guys have already been talking about this today, but Portlandia premieres on IFC this Friday. You can actually already see it on Hulu, or if you want to see it live here in Portland, you can go to the Mission Theater, and Aaron Mesh's Beer and Movie series is actually hosting it with live bands at the Mission Theater every Friday night. So there's a bunch of different ways you can see this show. You frankly can't escape it. So right now, we've had a chance to see it, and so a lot of what we were talking about this week is just how we felt about it, which is, honestly, it's pretty damn great. It's a pretty good show. So, it's the best sketch comedy show about Portland there has ever been.
I think it was our friend Mike Russell, and he said, I couldn't figure out, did you ever do this where you read somebody's review? And granted, this was on Twitter, so it's even more difficult because it's condensed. But did you ever read a review of something, and for the life of you, you can't figure out whether they're kind of giving it the thumbs up or the thumbs down, and you're reading it again going, this seems like it's a compliment, maybe? I don't know. Mike Russell described Portlandia, which I have not seen. And Don, I don't know if you have.
I have seen it.
So I want to ask you your thoughts here in a second. Russell, though, he said that it reminded him of what what Linklater's movie Slacker would have looked like if it was created by the head of a television network. If it was reduced to a series of sketches made by CBS, it's what Slacker would have looked like. But then later he said something – He said it reminded him of the grungy sketch from the old Ben Stiller show. And I can't, and so one of those seems like a compliment, one of them doesn't. So I couldn't figure out where he actually stood on it.
I think that's because nobody quite knows what to do with it yet. I mean, what I finally came down to, and literally what we printed in the paper was, we all sat around at the office and watched it. And then Aaron just taped what we had to say about it, and then he just printed it. Because we were like, there's no point in, like, describing the sketches. Everybody kind of knows. There's the Dream of the 90s one. There's one about a pair of people, of women who work at a feminist bookstore who, even though they say they're inclusive, they don't want to help anyone. There's a very angry bike rider. There is a pair of diners who are so concerned about the provenance of their chicken that they are going to be eating that they leave the restaurant and drive out to the farm to meet the chicken to make sure that they have been appropriately cared for and loved during their short life. I mean, the kind of things that it's exactly what you think they're going to talk about, and it's just kind of one of those things that are it's hit and miss. It's exactly kind of it's like watching Saturday Night Live. You're not going to like a lot of it, but if there's a good cast, you know, there's a lot of great points.
Now, is this a Is it a full season? I mean, how many episodes are they going to be doing?
There's six episodes. Each episode is, I think, 24 minutes long plus commercials.
Okay.
So it's a half an hour long show. And so far, it's pretty good. I think the reason you're not getting an overwhelming, my God, this is amazing, is that it's sketch comedy, which means one second it's great and the next minute it's kind
of
a dud.
Right.
The through line, though, is Carrie Brownstein is really, really funny. She's kind of crazy, and she's got this undercurrent. We talk about this in the story. She's got this undercurrent of anger to her characters that I think is very Portland. She nails it. The idea that all of us are trying so hard to be good people and nice people, and yet there's people. Everybody else irritates us.
Right, right.
And the way that they're trying to be nice and good is horribly irritating.
When does it actually premiere? When is it on IFC?
Friday.
It's on Friday. Okay.
At 9 p.m. Yeah, Friday at 9 p.m. on IFC. But you can go and see it on Hulu right now. So, we have a lot to say about it, basically about the fact that all Portlanders are self-serious a-holes, including us. And
that's
what's funny about it is because they make fun of every type of self-serious a-hole there is in Portland.
To dovetail with everybody here real quickly, what did you think of it?
I agree with what you said. I think I don't know how successful it's going to be with the rest of the nation because they really, really do capture a very specific kind of not even just Portland, but what we think of ourselves here in Portland. It's like self-referential parody,
right,
that will be gotten by the people who actually live in the town and are making the self-referential references. And like you said, it is hit and miss. Some of it is very, very funny, and some of it just really isn't. But it really is very Portland. The sketch with the couple in the restaurant asking about the chicken, and then continuing to ask the questions about the chicken. It's like, well, here's the folder. His name was Colin. You know, this way, look at it. It's like, but was he happy? Did he have friends?
Like, did Colin have a lot of friends? And she's like, well, you know what? I'm not at liberty to speak about that. And they're like, oh, really?
Yeah,
so, you don't know if he had friends.
And so then they leave to go drive the 30 miles to the farm,
right,
to go make sure the chicken had been happy. And if that sketch had ended there, it would have been hilarious and dead on. But they revisit those characters out at the farm later, and that stuff just isn't quite as successful. So it is, like you said about Carrie Brownstein, she's not only really, really funny, but she's also considering, you know, she's working with Fred Armiston, who has been doing this for a long time. She sells it really well. She commits to her characters in a way that you don't see a lot of sketch comedy people do. And she's new to comedy. So she's really good. It is actually very good.
Is there any sort of...
I highly suggest you read it.
Is there any indication as to, I don't know how IFC works. It's like sometimes IFC is such a strange network because it's like it was the Henry Rollins show where it was like, it was that thing where I just wouldn't take it off my TiVo like season pass list for the longest time because they never said it wasn't coming back, but they never really said it was. And then they just ended up running the same like five episodes over and over for like 7 years, it just seemed like. So is there any word on how people outside of, whether it's playing outside of Portland, whether it's resonating elsewhere?
So far, the only people who have seen it are critics, you know, people who've gotten previews, and they seem to really like it. But it's major market. Again, it's places that are kind of like Portland, like Austin or, you know, like Williamsburg or New York, that kind of stuff. So there hasn't been a general response yet. There will be after Friday.
That probably is where it's most important that it play anyway, though, is it, you know, in the,
yeah, exactly. I mean, and according to Kerry, who was talking about this at the premiere at the Hollywood Theater last week, I believe, you know, IFC hasn't said one way or another yet. They don't have an indication of whether they'll be able to continue this or not. But, you know, it does resonate beyond Portland. I just don't know how much. I think if I lived in Austin, you know, a lot of it would still make a ton of sense. I mean, I think it would still be funny. You would still see yourself in it. It's just a matter of whether it can, you know, create as big of a buzz. What I really think it does is, and all sketch comedy is kind of like this right now, you know, you get your hits on Facebook. You get your hits, you know, on the individual sketches, you know, 3-minute sketches that go viral.
Well,
that's kind of how SNL is too right now.
Sketch comedy on television has become like the music industry, where it's all about the hit single. I mean, if the album is great, that's wonderful, but it's all about the CeeLo method of just getting the one single out there that everybody is watching.
You know, Saturday Night Live digital shorts. I mean, that's what you're going to watch.
Right.
Or you're going to hear that there was one specific sketch that was good, and you're going to go to Hulu or to YouTube and Google it and see if you can find it. And you're like, yeah, that was awesome. You're not going to watch probably the whole show.
It also had a really modest budget, too, and that'll work in its favor because it's on IFC.
Yeah.
And I think it was what? It was like $1 million for like all 6 episodes or something.
Which is dirt cheap.
Which is
as far as I know. And they used almost all local crew, all local actors. You'll see some local faces in there. You'll see people that you don't know who they are, but you recognize them. And you can't figure out if you recognize them because they're a barista or they're on stage.
I think...
they're probably both.
And I did just remember, there is one sketch that's very funny. It's about... that goes on way too long, but the idea is hilarious. It's about an adult hide-and-seek league.
Oh, right,
Portland adult hide-and-seek league, yeah. Are you talking about the older woman who calls him out?
Yes. Yeah. But also, just conceptually, that is such a Portland thing.
Well, can I just tell you this? Okay, here's proof of maybe why the show is fantastic, and I haven't seen any of it yet, because I saw something go by on Facebook the other day about blah, 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 adult hide-and-seek league. And I swear to God, until this very moment, I thought it was just a real thing that was happening in Portland. I had no, until this very moment when you told me it was Portlandia, I just assumed it was some other, like, weirdly, like, adolescent thing that it was, like, springing up somewhere in Portland, probably, you know, probably in Northeast. So I had no idea.
Probably
but
in Northeast.
That's
yeah, there's
awesome.
Some unsettling truths to this. There's a sketch about a pair of very angry dog activists who are furious that a dog has been tied to a pole outside of a restaurant.
Well,
that this dog's rights are being trampled, and this dog is being, you know, hurt by being tied to a stationary object to the point where they cause a ruckus in the middle of the restaurant, demanding that they find the owner of this dog who has, you know, abused it in such a manner.
Well, I'll be really curious to see.
It's very Portland. That's what you keep saying over and over about it. It's really Portland.
I'll be curious to see how it plays, and then I'll be curious to see what other cities, and I think probably this will be a thing you'll be able to see online, what other cities look at it and recognize themselves. In other words, what other cities contain these traits? There's your Austin and, you know, in parts of New York, and where else in the country they look and they go, oh my God, we're just like Portland. We're lame, you know, in some weird way or whatever. What else is of note in the New Willamette?
Well, you know, you always say that I bring you stuff that makes you hungry, so
yes.
I have to continue that trend. There is, in this town right now, available a bacon brownie sundae.
Of course there
is. There is a brownie that is made with bacon fat with pieces of crispy bacon inside of the brownie. And then it is topped with vanilla ice cream, homemade caramel, and caramelized bacon bits, and whipped cream.
See, now it's like, because of the last conversation, now I'm just viewing everything through the prism of, would this work as a Portlandia sketch?
Yeah, it actually totally would. I mean, it's kind of jumped the shark. I mean, bacon is so, I mean, I feel like bacon is kind of over, but... I mean, I'm sick of bacon, and I worship bacon, and I'm sick of it. But we had to make an exception. We kind of have like almost a no bacon shtick rule at this point in the paper because we're kind of sick of bacon things,
right.
But this was so good. So it's actually at the Fishwife, which is a restaurant that's like 2 decades old up in St. John's. It's a seafood restaurant. It's a family seafood restaurant that's been there forever. And one of our writers went because a reader emailed us. They're like, my God, the bacon brownie sundae. And we were like, at the Fishwife? That sounds unsavory.
I used to live a block from there. When I owned a house in North Portland, I lived a block from there. And it is such like a divey looking place. But about 5 years, I finally went, I've got to go to this place and just see what
it
is.
Awesome.
The food is great. Their food is great. They do great fish.
Yeah, it's a great place. It's a great place. But you would never expect like a family seafood restaurant to harbor this really bizarre bacon dessert. But then again, I mean, I suppose they can't make a fish brownie, so they had to branch out a little bit.
Awesome.
But they've been doing this. They've been doing it for quite a while. They say it's one of their most popular desserts. They were totally confused that we were even interested in it. And we're like, well, trust me, a lot of people might be asking for it sometime soon. We put an entire full-page picture of it. We're kind of starting a new feature called Hot Plate, where we're basically just once a month going to do a big sexy photo of something that we find delicious and then make everybody drool.
See, this is...
So there's a big sexy, kind of like a pinup picture of this brownie drizzled with caramel, and there's big bacon chunks, and it's all melty, and like it's half eaten, and some people are going to find it disgusting, and the rest of us are just going to drool all over it.
I do have to say that this is really one of the things that I love about Portland, though, is... You know, as much as, you know, as a show like Portlandia can hone in on and you know, identify some of the quirks or some of the sort of behavioral tics and mannerisms and attitudinal things the city has, what really, really sells the whole thing to me, and I'm looking at a photograph of it right now, and it looks fantastic. the thing that I love about Portland, though, is that it's not like a contrivance or a put-on, as demonstrated by the fact that when you went there to talk to them about it, they were mystified that you would even care, you know? Like, it was just a thing they had on the menu, and they had no idea why anybody would find it all that compelling. And that really is – that is what sells any sort of bizarre behavior in Portland. Awesome. We've taken up, like, 9 hours of your time here, so we should let you skedaddle. But you got to come visit us one of these days in the studio. I know you guys are real busy over there.
Absolutely.
You got to drop by and say howdy. The new issue on stands now, reader in print, in Willamette Week or online at WWeek.com. Arts and culture editor Kelly Clark. Have a fantastic day.
Have a great day, guys.
Talk to you soon. There you go. That's Kelly Clark, ladies and gentlefolk. Wow. That does look – and here's the thing. And you know, St. John's, I have such a weird relationship with St. John's. It's just such a great, awful place.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just – and it's becoming every – I don't know. It's becoming a little – I don't know if gentrified is the right word, but the texture of St. John's has really changed over the last couple of years. And I know I start to sound like you should have seen it back whenever. Because it's not like I've lived here for 50 years. But, I mean, just in the 12 or 13 years I've been here, it started to – I don't know. Just every now and again you'll drive by and you'll see like some sort of organic deli appear, you know?
But it's so slow, though, because I bought my house there in 94, I think it was, 93 or 94. And everyone was like – oh, St. John's is the next place that's going to be the big thing. St. John's is the next big thing. And then, like, you know, Alberta, like, right. You know, got big. Then, no, St. John's is the next big thing. Then Mississippi gets it. And so I owned my house there for 10 years, and they kept telling me that the peninsula out there was going to be the next big hotspot and that our housing prices were going to go through the roof and everyone's going to be off. Never happened.
No.
You know, it got a little less skeezy. It got a little less meth dealery. I didn't see quite as many, like, you know, midgets and guys with no legs as I did when I first moved there. But it's still never really quite ever gentrified.
I get the feeling that St. John's is sort of like, it is like the last place on the list. It's going to be the last kid picked for softball.
I think so.
You know, it's like you clean everywhere else in your house and then there's that drawer under the microwave and you go, God, I just don't even want to think about cleaning that place out. It's just going to be horrible. But that's sort of what makes it, that's what makes it great. So, awesome. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964. We should take this opportunity right here to talk about our good friends at Squires Electric. Actually, just coming on the heels, sort of, that whole discussion about me fixing the car and just being intimidated and overwhelmed by all things vehicular and automotive. I know that there are people, you know, who do know that stuff inside and out, and they understand how things work, and, you know, something is... And it's not just the fixing something. See, that's the thing. It's like a lot of people, and I'm not trying to diminish this, I'm saying a lot of people can fix stuff, you know, or you can find the manual of the book, or you can sort of, like, look at a diagram and kind of puzzle out, like, maybe what needs to be... That's only part of it. And in a way, that's almost like a minority part of it. That's like 40%. The bulk of it is figuring out what is wrong. I mean, that's the, like, pulling out the fuse. Let's be honest, that was basically just following like a tab A into slot B flip chart for children, where I swear to God, if you pull off the fuse panel, which I couldn't find, of course, because I would have no way to know what it looks like. So I went online to like the, you know, Ford.com, and it was like printing at the owner's manual. And it said, it's the big panel that says fuses next to the steering wheel. So, which I had never noticed.
But the thing is, it's in a different place on most cars. And to be fair, they do hide some of them. Like, I had a little Ford S10 pickup truck for a long time. And the fuse panel was actually under the dash. And you had to kind of lay on your back and stick your head under the steering wheel and look up to get at it.
To get the jaws of life out. And so I pull off the fuse box, and on the inside there is just like a little graph. And I swear to God, and it's just all of the fuses in a row. And then there's a little chart showing you. It's like a seating chart for the Rose Garden, where you're going, okay, we're in the Orchestra 5. That's right here. And I'm looking, and for the one for the 12 volt, it actually was just a huge picture of a cigarette. And then my peeps at home will appreciate this. It was a fuse number 42. And so I was like, 42, righteous. And so, you know, I pulled the thing out with like my pliers, you know, and then, but that's just following, again, basic, like step-by-step instructions for idiots, you know, for me. It's the figuring out what was wrong. Because if you had not, if Thomas had not told me, like, it's probably a fuse, you know, it's probably right over there somewhere, you can fix it for like $2. I would have taken the car, as dumb as this sounds, to the Ford place. And I would have been like, well, something's broken. I guess you'll just have to fix it and charge me whatever that costs. And I'm sure the labor cost is reasonable. Goodbye now. And I would have left. I just had no idea. So, you know, if you're facing that, you know, at home or your office or, you know, with your electrical system, or if you, it's not even sometimes that things aren't working. It's just that you want things to work better. You know, like your broadband isn't quite getting the job done. And, you know, it's not like on the end of whatever the service you're paying for. There's just something in the wiring, or you're just not able to, you're not able to plug everything into the room without stuff going and shorting out somewhere. You can't run the toaster and the blender and a lamp at the same time, because then it's like your lawn sprinklers turn on or something. Figuring out what is wrong is, that's the bulk of the battle right there. So you contact Squires Electric at 503-252-1609. 503-252-1609 or SquiresElectric.com. That is the website for Squires Electric. SquiresElectric.com or 503-252-1609. No job too small or too large. And that, they mean that. That's not just a slogan. They've done everything from one single socket. And then I swear to God, later, that guy who had the one single socket done in his house, one outlet, later on they did an entire condo that the guy was building. So no matter how small the job is, if it has to do with wiring, Ethernet wiring, intercom wiring, electrical wiring of any kind, your home or business, they can make your life easier. Squires Electric at SquiresElectric.com or 503-252-1609. That's 503-252-1609. A proud sponsor of the Rick Emerson Show. That is SquiresElectric.com. We have to take a break. We come back. On the other side, we're going to do something.
Clown Watch.
We got to get to the Geek Watch as well.
Yeah.
A whole bunch of things. We'll get to the top five later on as well. Top five classic bubblegum songs of all time. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Never I'd met you, I'd never have seen you cry. Not for a first hello, we'd never have to say goodbye. If never I held you, my feelings would never show. It's time I start walking, but there's so much that you'll never know. I keep telling you a hard luck woman, you ain't a hard luck woman. Red's the sailor's only daughter, the child of the water, too proud to be a queen. Red, I really love you, I can't forget about. A hard luck woman, baby, till you find your man. Before I go, let me kiss you and wipe the tears from your eyes.
a hard luck woman, baby, till you find your man. Raise the sailor's only daughter, a child of the water.
News Network. listening to the Emerson News Network.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Hello. We have a clown watch.
Here's your clown watch for Wednesday on the Rick Emerson radio program. Seems like these are cropping up with alarming regularity.
There have been so many clown stories lately, and there's sort of a clown
uprising,
clown zeitgeist kind of a thing going on. So, I want to tell you, I actually had two clown stories I could choose from today, but I wanted to.
I think one is enough.
I wanted to save the one from I wanted to do the one from yesterday. So.
And here's your clown watch for Wednesday on the Rick Emerson radio program.
Being entertained by a clown right after in vitro fertilization could be baby-making gold, according to a study in the medical journal Fertility and Sterility.
I think baby-making gold refers to something else.
The one-year-long study by doctors at the Asaf Harofe Medical Center in Zrifin, Israel, involved 219 women. Half of them were treated to a medical clowning encounter after having undergone in vitro fertilization.
A medical clowning encounter.
Results showed that 36% of women who were treated to a 20-minute routine of jokes, magic tricks, and other comedic clowning acts after in vitro became pregnant. In contrast, only 20% of the women in the group that wasn't exposed to clowns got pregnant, according to the study.
A medical clowning sounds like a thing where they replace your heart with just like some sort of a spring-loaded like snake canister.
Surprise!
You know? Hey, you know, you thought you were getting a pacemaker, but instead it's one of those flowers that squirts water.
The findings expand on research done by the study's principal author, Dr. Shevek Friedler, a graduate of the Jacques Lecoq School of Mime and Theater in Paris, France. My background is in clowning and movement,
said
he
who?
Told Nature. Shevek Friedler.
Of where?
The Jacques Lecoq School of Mime and Theater. My background is in clowning and movement, he told Nature.com in a 2006 interview. Uh-huh. I'm also a physician who works in vitro fertilization. I thought we could combine the two.
So he's like the Patch Adams of the OBGYN ward, basically. Okay, that's wonderful.
So a study holds promise for women seeking to get pregnant through in vitro fertilization and also identifies comedy as a key de-stressor during what could be to patients a harrowing medical procedure.
Is the place really called Jacques Lecoq?
Jacques Lecoq Mime and Theater, School of Mime and Theater.
All right. Awesome.
Anyway, yes, while medical clowns have usually been associated with pediatric care, their use with adult patients is on the rise, according to the website aheartforclowning.com.
All right. Can we be done with this now? There you go. There's your clown watch for...
How terrible would it be that you go into the hospital, you've been having trouble getting pregnant, you've been stressing over this, you and your husband have been trying to get you knocked up, you're finally like getting like an egg implanted in your uterus, you go through this procedure, and then somebody sticks their head and goes, hey, we think this might help, and a clown comes in.
And just because you're thinking to yourself, well, like, I think I'm through the rough patch of it now, this, you know, I'm through the stressful part of this procedure, and this, you know, thank God the day's only going to get better from here on out. This can't possibly get any worse.
You have no pants on, you're still in the stirrups, you're trapped, there's nowhere to go.
And a guy comes in with a balloon dog at the end of a string.
Freaking clown comes, honk, honk, hey, let's get you pregnant.
Hey, you know, we were talking about, we've had this low-level discussion about trying to find a fetish that doesn't already exist, we make a little porn money on that.
Mm-hmm.
But how about this? This just occurred to me. Now, there's already the clown fetish, so this wouldn't be that. What if, now I know that you will resist this idea, but you got to hear it all the way through. I know, Dawn, that this is going to strike you as a horrible idea.
Okay.
Something that you should resist with every fiber of your being.
Okay.
What if, though, as a promotional tool for this very fine radio program, we just, instead of getting instead of a kooky like woodpecker holding a guitar with sunglasses, we just had an evil clown who was the mascot of the Rick Emerson Show, who just went to try to spread the word of this program, like, you know, just by strolling around downtown, you know, plying his clown trade with whoever he might find.
You know, on the one hand, I really like that idea. On the other hand, that means that at some point I might have to actually be in the room with the evil clown.
Well, yeah, we'd have to audition who was going to play the part. We'd have to design his makeup.
Well, no, you know who we work with for that.
Mm.
Dave Helfrich.
That's what your thinking toque does for you right there.
There's a guy
that's
who
what
could
I'm talking about.
Help us design
the evilest of clowns.
The evilest of clowns.
But you know, but in a way that it would look actually like a real clown, not like the guy with his penis out on the cover of the clown porn who's just who's just some freak who's speckled. This would be like an actual clown, but then scary.
Yeah, and he would be whatever his name is, the Rick Emerson Show evil clown.
Now, I did this years ago when I was this would not be the first time, by the way, that this show has been represented by a clown mascot. I don't even like to tell the story because it just reveals. I mean, I don't think it will surprise anybody that that I'm just kind of a jackass. And as much as I sometimes make fun of like terrible DJs and bad morning show hosts, the thing is, I feel like I'm in a position to do that because I understand what it's like to be a bad morning show host because I have been a kooky morning show host, really, and I still am in many ways. There's just no getting around that fact. So. Anyway, I know of what I ridicule. Mm. But when I was in Salt Lake and I did this morning show called Drive By Radio, and so we at one point decided that we needed a mascot on the show. And so what better mascot than hey, a clown? Because even then I found clowns sort of fascinating and terrible. And so, but we didn't have any money because, of course, then as now, you know, they just never wanted to give my show much of a promotional budget. And so we decided, well, we're going to have to do this on a budget. And then it was like all together in my head, the collision of great things. Suddenly the idea appeared. And so we had a listener who was this really, really tall guy. We were looking for somebody who was sort of big, who was sizable. And I forget the guy's real name, but he was like 6'4" and I think he weighed 300 pounds. He was huge, just a wall of a man. And, we had a budget of like $14, and so we got a trench coat and just like a ratty sort of a rainbow wig from like a dollar store and a nose and then just some cheap grease paint that we found in a closet left over from Halloween, and that's all we had. That was the extent of the costume, and I think he just wore pajamas under the trench coat. And he was we named him Lucky Butt, the low-budget clown, and he was the Rick Emerson Show mascot. And so, but of course, never content to just leave something at, you know, hey, we've got a clown and he's in a trench coat and his name is Lucky Butt. The first gag we had him do is this is right after they passed one of those laws that said like you weren't allowed to feed other people's parking meters. And so we had him go down and feed parking meters like on behalf. And then I think he was given a ticket by the city for like $400, which we promised to pay and then never did. So thanks. I think he was actually on the phone with us. He had a cell phone because it was in 96. So I think he had a cell phone and I think he was actually on the phone with our morning show. And he's like, so I'm down here and I'm feeding parking meters for the Rick Emerson. Oh, they're ticketing. There's a man handing me something. No, he's a police officer. No, I'm being handed a $400. $400? I can't pay this. And I think we just said, like, no problem, Lucky Bud. We'll take care of that. Hey, now. Wah, wah. And it just never did. But at one point, we decided that that just wasn't ludicrous enough, so we came up with a contest. And amazingly enough, the name Lucky Butt predated the contest. Lucky Butt just sort of occurred to us, like out of the void, out of the ether. The contest was that we just took. I think that we actually funded this out of pocket, by the way, which is a demonstration of how hilarious we decided that this contest was. We believed this contest to be so fantastic that we were willing to actually provide the money ourselves. I think we just took paper money of varying denominations. But the thing is, you wouldn't know what the denomination was. We just rolled up paper money really, really tightly, and then we would just place it into the into the demarcation of his buttocks. And then the thing is, we would have listeners come in, and they would have to pull the rolled up money out of his area.
That's terrible.
Yeah, but the thing is, you wouldn't know where there was like a $1 bill or a $20 bill until you sort of pulled it out and were and unrolling. And then even if it's $20, it's $20 that smells like the inside of a clown's ass.
Well, yeah.
That's
horrible. And, that's a horrible promotion.
That is really what I used. One of the greatest communication technologies in the history of the world for. I, in fact, inserted money into the ass of a clown and then made people from a radio audience come and pull it out live on the air.
Yeah, not many people can say that.
No. So I forget why we stopped using him for things. I think he got angry about the parking ticket and said that he was going to kill us. And so we just, I think we stopped answering the, I think we blocked his phone number and wouldn't come to the door.
We're talking about the clown thing and the fetish thing. We were talking about subsections of things, and this occurred to me. Because obviously there is some sort of, you know, need for clown porn. That's obviously there. What if, though, rather than just clown porn, but clowns in specific professions, Like, because there's this whole thing, you know, the doctor clowns, and we could just do a series of videos. There's no sex involved, but it's just, but maybe there are like sexy ladies interacting with the clowns. But yeah, you'd have a clown cop. In another one, it could be a clown plumber who comes to like fix somebody's, you know, plumbing.
What would the plot consist of, though? He just comes and he fixes the pipes and he leaves?
Yes.
But he's a clown?
Yes.
Okay.
But if you have like a if you have a fetish
for clowns,
In non-clowning professions.
Is that a fetish that exists?
I don't know, but maybe you know someone must have it.
That's true. I wonder if that is. I wonder if that is a widespread interest of people who they want to see the juxtaposition of those two things:
yes.
Clown with a non-clown context.
Yeah, there's someone somewhere who is going, God, if I could just see a video with a clown lumberjack, I would pay $300 for that video.
Well, Christ, I never would have thought that there was this some fetish where the women just lick balloons and then pop them. I mean, fully clothed women where no sex is happening, and they're not even phallic balloons. They're just round. And she just goes, ooh, it's so rubbery, and then licks it. And then the guy goes, oh, it's the best thing ever.
And this would be like attractive women interacting with clowns who are dealing with them. And that's the whole thing, is she's a good-looking woman, and she needs to get, like, say, her car fixed. And she goes to the garage, but the mechanic is a clown.
Well, fair enough. Okay, sure. Did you know this? Maybe you did. You seem like the type who would know this. Did you, no offense, did you know that there is, I don't even want to call it porn because, again, there's no sex. Did you know that there's a whole line of specialty, not even films, but I mean just, I don't know, just movies, you know, videos. Did you know there's a whole niche for videos that just, it just shows like clothed but hot girls. Being stabbed?
No, but that really doesn't surprise me.
Or sometimes just stabbing themselves. It's like, what's this? Well, it's Janice. She's sitting at home in a schoolgirl outfit. Now she's just going to stab herself in the eye. You know, and then it's like the end.
There are a lot of men that
and it's not like
enjoy violence.
And I don't believe it's like a real, like, I don't think it's like a real stabbing. I mean,
no.
I think it's like a, you know, sort of like a, where you get the springy knife stabbing or whatever. But you just think to yourself, how does one discover that's a thing that you can make money on? And then how do you recruit women to be in those films? Like, what kind of classified ad do you place for, like, woman, to be stabbed in the leg with springy stage knife, you know?
I'll bet you there's fetish videos about schoolgirls cutting themselves.
Probably. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, what is that? That's that rule 34. If it exists, there is porn for it.
Yeah.
Like, that's the whole thing of, like, the balloon fetish and the sneezing thing. You're just like, and the only thing I can come up with...
rubber snakes? Do you think somebody has a fetish for rubber snakes?
Well, there is a fetish for rubber, and I would imagine that there is a fetish for snakes. Now, but people who have a fetish for snakes, I can't believe we're having this conversation again. It's still inside the clown watch still.
Because there's all kinds of things you could do with rubber snakes.
Are there, Dawn?
I'm just saying.
You're not thinking...
It'd be a lot safer than, like, a real snake.
Anything in particular? I remember seeing when I was a kid that LaToya Jackson issue of Playboy, where she's nude and then wrapped in a boa constrictor. And at one point, the boa constrictor is... There's nothing, obviously...
Well, there was the famous Nastassia Kinski poster.
Right, and she's encircled by that. And you think to yourself, well, that's, you know... I mean, it's not too hard to figure out the appeal there. And yet, it is hard to figure out the appeal, because it's like, it doesn't turn me on. Like, I don't, like... Like, even seeing the LaToya Jackson thing, and she's an attractive woman, but it's like, you saw that and you went... Okay, there's a snake, I guess. That's the thing of, like, the girl, like, the chicks in Penthouse peeing, where you're just like, what possible? But the only conclusion I can come to with stuff like that, or the balloon thing, or the stabbing thing, the sneezing thing, we're like, that has got to be a thing where whoever created that niche just got tired of going to the video store and looking for that section, and it wasn't there.
How about really, really good-looking girls with yo-yos?
Where, like, they're just doing yo-yo tricks?
Yeah, but doing actually good yo-yo tricks.
Like, they're the Duncan Yo-Yo Master?
Yes. I bet those would sell.
Probably. Or maybe, wait, no. No, there's something there. There's something. Well, I was going to say the chicks, not just yo-yos, I was going to say there's probably something for chicks like playing video games, but that kind of already exists. I mean, that's like if you just spend any time on, like, 4chan or Gizmodo or something. There's just, you know, like some greased up bikini cheerleader playing, you know, playing Dead Rising.
Yeah. I think we're narrowing in on this, though.
No, there's something there. The thing about the rubber snakes, though, is you got to figure the people who have the snake fetish, they're probably not going to want fake snakes. They're going to want the real deal. And probably people who have a rubber fetish, that might work, except any number of people, some percentage of people with a rubber fetish will also, totally separate from that, have a phobia of snakes. So it seems like we're immediately cutting out a large section of that niche. We're immediately losing 20% of our prospective business space there. So there's something there. What's like sneezing but not sneezing?
Nothing is really like sneezing.
I was trying to think if there was some equivalent to sneezing. There's, you know, and it's like ear cleaning doesn't really work. Ooh, hey, what about having your teeth cleaned? What about something with teeth? Dental work, and I don't mean like drilling. I mean like something like flossing. Is there a flossing fetish?
Maybe, yeah.
Because flossing seems kind of sexual in that it's like something going into something else. You know, it's like, and then there's the object going into the tight space.
And it's a lady's mouth.
It's a lady's mouth, so it's a, and she's putting something into her mouth, and it's also going into a, crevice like area, and. Even I feel dirty talking about this, so it means that we must be onto something. There must be.
And yet, if you Google
flossing fetish,
you don't really come up with anything.
Are you Googling it in quotes?
No.
You should Google that phrase in quotes and then say 10 Hail Marys.
Flossing.
The proof that we are closing in on it is that I feel bad even talking about that out loud. I feel like I'm being covered in ick.
I don't know. Triumphant teeth flossing fetish. There's a YouTube video. Somebody on a message board asking about a flossing fetish.
Who could we ask about this? Do we know anybody who... We could ask Jim Willig about this. He knows what sells. He works at Fantasy.
Yeah.
He knows what people buy. By the way, somebody's just made the observation here. Far too much time on Google, not enough real sex. I don't know if they're indicating that we should have more real sex happening on the program or that you and I are just spending too much time on Google. Probably one of those things is true.
Yeah. Really.
All right. Well, let's end the clown watch for the love of sweet Christ almighty. This is like one of those studies they have at, you know, like they would do this like the University of Washington where they just tether a bunch of electrodes to a guy's junk and then show him a bunch of movies, you know, just stills of like, you know, like a honeybee flying around and then like the Grand Coulee Dam and then like a jackhammer and then of a shoe and they just try to figure out like what is, you know, what's sort of turning him on. All right. I hate to do this, but here's the thing. While you read this next news story, I swear to God, I'm gonna walk into the kitchen for like 30 seconds and fill my coffee cup.
Okay.
So I would take a break, except that I know you had to do ham-fisted radio today. That happening at 4 p.m. Pacific time at Cascadia.fm. Anything in particular on the docket today?
No, nothing specific.
Just you and Bobby Roberts entertaining the people with the sheer force of wit.
Yes.
Just the power of your amusement.
That's it, exactly.
All right. Here's Don Taylor while I step into the kitchen.
Alabama Governor-elect Robert Bentley might not seem race, but religion is another matter entirely. Speaking at Martin Luther King's former Baptist church only hours after he was sworn in on Monday, the new Republican governor told the Montgomery, Alabama crowd that although he's colorblind, he doesn't consider non-Christians to be his brothers and sisters. Now I will have to say that if we don't have the same daddy, we're not brothers and sisters, he said. So anybody here today who has not accepted Jesus Christ as their savior, I'm telling you, you're not my brother and you're not my sister, and I want to be your brother. Bentley staffers didn't return a phone call to the Birmingham News about the remarks, which were picked up by national media. Asked about her boss's comments later, Bentley's communications director told the paper, he's the governor of all the people, Christians and non-Christians alike.
So here's the thing at the coffee pot. I put the water in. I put the coffee in.
On,
no. Now, listen, why do you jump right to I forgot to press the button? No. Okay. I mean, it's not like that's, I guess, outside the realm of possibility. But no, I put the water in. I put the coffee in. Press the button, close the whole thing up. I go back in there now. The water has run through and is like piping hot, but the coffee is still completely dry. Oh, I must have not set the thing down in there correctly, or maybe I didn't. So I adjusted the little basket.
Did you pour the water into the
thing? The reservoir?
Yeah. Okay.
Wait, or did I?
Because if you just put it in the thing and then just stick it in there, it just gets hot. You have to pour it
into the back. Sort of thing.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to be right back. Hold on a second. That'd be
okay. I could read another story or something.
Just do that.
I'll do that. You enjoy that.
All right.
It turns out fish can distinguish between larger and smaller quantities with an additional ability to count up to three, according to research on tropical angelfish. Angelfish are regarded as being one of the world's most intelligent fish, but scientists believe other fish species also possess the math-related skills outlined in the new paper. So, fish can count up to three.
Okay.
We all think we know what we mean by counting, but do we really? Said co-author Robert Gillet. Is recounting a series of 1 to 100 counting? Is 2 plus 3 equals 5 counting? Is calculating the square root of a number counting? Or is perhaps mathematics necessary for quantum physics counting? They decided that mathematical abilities vary tremendously, even within our own species. So most biological, including behavioral traits we initially believe to be unique to our species, actually have, you know, analogies in other animals.
I'm sorry, fish can count?
Fish can count.
How do they decide that? What was the experiment that they did?
Well, they took the angelfish, which are considered among the more intelligent.
Are those
of the
fish that kill everything?
No, they're the ones with the big spiky bits that come off the top and the bottom, and they're kind of flat.
Right.
And they're tropical.
Okay, all right.
They are, by the way, really really beautiful. And I will tell you that when I was in Hawaii, there's this area you can go scuba diving, snorkeling, and it's just for tourists because the fish know people are going to feed them. So there's a buttload of fish there.
Right.
And you get there and the guide guy who drives you there says, here, have this giant chunk of French bread. You can feed the fish. And then you swim out like to this reef and you have this French bread and a couple of fish go, hey, that person has French bread. And the next thing you know, you are surrounded by fish, like in one of those Jacques Cousteau specials, which is beautiful when you see it on TV.
But terrifying in real life.
And it's kind of terrifying when you're underwater and breathing through a hose. And these fish, they're so pretty, but the ones that are actually in the ocean are like about 2 feet across.
Yeah.
And when you're surrounded by 50 of them that are going, give me food!
And also, you don't know what they're attracting. Because that's the whole thing, is as Qui-Gon Jinn said, there's always a bigger fish.
Yeah.
And so you never know if there's just something huge, like something. What is that thing blocking out the sun? You know, you've met Todd Tulsis, right?
Yeah.
You know that Todd Tulsis, last year, he and his wife, they travel a lot. And they traveled to, I want to say Tahiti, but it was a place like that. But they traveled somewhere, like in the Bahamas, where you can swim with whale sharks. Or shark whales, one of the two. But I think it's actually, they're not man-eaters. They're harmless, except in the inadvertent way. But they're massive. They are the largest shark, I believe, on Earth. And they have, I believe he said that they are the smaller ones are the size of a school bus. And then they sort of go up from there. But they're really, really docile and tame. You know, that you can inadvertently, though, he said, be sucked into their mouth if they happen to open the mouth while you're nearby. Sort of, and then there's just a vacuum, and you just get spiraled right into their mouth. There's like a suction that happens.
And then they go, oops,
yeah.
Sorry.
And he said it was the thing where it's like they're beautiful in real life and you see them on television, you're like, oh, such dignity and quiet grace these creatures have. But then when you're next to them, he's like, you are next to a thing that is the size of a bus that has a mouth like a hubcap, you know, to begin with. And some of them are much bigger than that. And he said, and also like you realize that every time one fish is somewhere, every other section of the food chain is nearby or closing in at some point because all of the food chain is sort of connected. So, you know, it's like, so where there's sharks, there's pilot fish. Where there's pilot fish, there's microbes. Where there's big sharks, there's smaller sharks. And it's like, and he said, you don't really realize that until you're in the water. And you realize that nature viewed through the television screen and nature viewed like through your own terrified corneas is not quite the same thing at all.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus. All right.
Well, they took these angelfish and placed them in special compartmentalized tanks and gave them a simultaneous choice between shoals containing different numbers of fish. The angelfish were always able to select the larger of the two groups, so long as the ratio between the shoals was 2-1 or above. Below that ratio, their choices were less predictable, suggesting a limit to their quantity estimation abilities. So they figured out that, they can tell the difference between 3 and 2 of
Jesus.
Something.
That's creepy. Cheryl wants to know that she's, by the way, those stupid fish bite. I have bad memories of that place. and then she says, rather politely, I think, did you give out today's clue? Which we have not, but we will do that here in just a moment. And then we got the top five coming up as well. The top five classic bubblegum songs of all time because of the passing of Mr. Don Kirshner. Here is Don Taylor.
Howard Stern has signed a contract to continue his morning radio show for another 5 years, in spite of saying he doesn't particularly enjoy it. He told CNN's Piers Morgan tonight that he feels compelled to be on the air.
This is Stern 1. Let's see, where did I...
I think it's my identity. I think it's my ego. It's also something that...
Insecurity?
Absolutely.
Stern says that one of the highlights of his career was getting a rare compliment from his father.
He said to me some years ago, and this really moved me, he said, you're a genius. And I was rocked because I never thought I'd hear those words. I didn't think that I was ever going to earn that respect in my father's eyes.
I know that I've certainly done this, but it's easy to kind of snark at Howard because, you know, he's I don't know, because he's off doing the satellite radio thing, which I think is an interstitial technology at best. And I think that is a thing that is going to be supplanted sooner rather than later. Satellite technology, satellite broadcasting of things like radio programs seems to me very much like Blu-ray discs, where it's not nearly the step up that like VHS to DVD was. You know, DVD to Blu-ray is not a huge advancement. And also Blu-ray is going to be obviated pretty quickly by things just being delivered over the Internet. I think sooner rather than later, satellite delivery of radio programs or satellite-based or primarily satellite-based delivery of radio programs is going to be supplanted by things just being delivered over the net. And I know that we will still use satellite technology for things. So, but that notwithstanding, I was actually watching a little bit of this last night, and I realized that it's the thing with Howard is he's sort of like Michael Jordan, coming back, and you know, people said that he was going to tarnish his legacy, and why didn't he go out on the top or whatever. And it's like, I think when you're Howard Stern, not unlike being Michael Jordan, it's like you have so little to prove, like, to anybody. I mean, there really is, you know, people can people sometimes roll their eyes at that King of All Media tag that he's given himself. But when you think about it, I mean, he really there are very few areas of the media that he has not made a demonstrable and sizable impact in, if he has not necessarily ruled all of them. I mean, just to say that you, for a time, were the most listened to radio personality in America, and then also coincidentally had a number one movie at the box office, that's a thing that, 1% of the population anywhere even has a chance of saying, much less achieving that. So
I realized recently that I feel about Howard Stern in a not dissimilar way to how I feel about Rush Limbaugh. I don't listen to Howard. His show has never appealed to me, but I really, really admire him for being good at what he does and for having the success that he has, in the media. I really admire him as an artist and as a businessman, even though I actually don't listen to his show.
Right.
I've never been a listener of his show. So it's and again, it's you and I have had long conversations about Rush Limbaugh that, I obviously find those kind of politics distasteful, but as just a pure showman.
Oh yeah, he is amazing.
He's unparalleled.
Amazing. He's the best there ever was. And Howard is similar to Oprah Winfrey in some ways too. That he really out of nothing. I mean, it's out of his own head and obviously some luck and some happenstance, but also just out of sheer work and determination and willpower, kind of created this media empire out of like nothing. I mean, Oprah was just, she was just like some TV weather girl, or whatever, and people also, forget that early on in Oprah's career, that she was doing exactly the kind of television that she later became the antithesis of, things that she now disdains, the sort of Jerry Springer, Ricky Lake, Geraldo Rivera kind of tawdry tabloid mm-hmm. programming. And she still does a little bit of that, it's sort of gussied up, but she has come so far from what she started as, just like Howard started as just another morning DJ, and he has kind of created or at least brought to the mainstream a kind of radio that wasn't really done beforehand. The idea that it is just I don't even say guy talk, but it is just sort of an unvarnished kind of conversation, and that it is very fluid and it's not as structured or mannered or formalized. Whereas as much as I love Rush Limbaugh, he very much is in some ways a throwback to old style radio delivery, where he's the big boss jock and the booming voice and hitting the post on the songs and, using all the catchphrases. And I don't think it's a big surprise to anybody. I mean, I have taken much more from Rush Limbaugh over the course of my career than I have from Howard Stern, because I actually never, for good or bad, I actually never even got to. I never heard Howard actually until I moved to Portland, because I never lived anywhere that his show was on, and there was no like internet or anything for me to hear him. So it's probably good that I never heard him early on, because I probably would have stolen a lot more from his show than I inadvertently duplicated already. But Christ, man, I can offer you $500 million to sit there and do something that, by his own admission, I think he would probably do for free anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's also a guy that he has no. And when I was in New York a few years ago for something or other. But I was in New York the day that he announced he was getting a divorce from Alison Stern. And he obviously had built so much of his persona on being, well, he's a wild man on the air, but he's a family man at home. And he has this really, really edgy, provocative program, but he's very conventional and conservative in his private life and has been with the same woman his whole life and whatever. And I do believe all that stuff. And I do believe Howard and Alison Stern when they talk about just growing apart or whatever. But it was really, really, it was weird to walk around New York that day, and it was on the front of the New York Post, where it was like Stern announces split with wife, and it was all anybody was talking about. It was the only thing anybody discussed. And you realize how much he just he really is radio in the very best sense of the word, in the very best way, because you realize how much everybody considered him a friend and a part of the family and somebody that had been their companion for however many years that they've been listening to him. And it was people, and I saw people that were really, I didn't want to say distraught, but I heard a lot of conversations with people who were very troubled. They were just like shaken by the fact that he was splitting up with his wife, because it was like hearing that a really good friend is getting a divorce. And where somebody goes, you know, did you hear that, you know, the Lipinskis are getting a divorce? You go, the Lipinskis? Oh my God. And then you say, if they can't keep it together, then who can? And it was really something that I think shook a lot of people, because he, you never get the sense that you're listening to like a shuck on the air, or that you're listening to a construct or a contrivance. He really is. But he, that day, I heard him the next morning. I listened to him a little bit doing the show, and he said that he, I don't know that he says anything in the interview with Piers Morgan about this, but he says that, you know, that he said that he himself did not know why he was continuing to do the show when the show was the reason that he was getting a divorce. He said that he was just, he said, it's not the chicks. He said, there's nobody else. He's like, I'm not having an affair. I'm not cheating. I don't want to, you know, be with anybody else. He said, I've got all the money I could ever need. I'm as famous as I could ever hope to be. He said, my wife just, he said, I am a workaholic and I spend all my time in the show and Allison is sick of it. And he's like, and he said, I don't know how to quit doing the show. And I don't know why I don't know how to quit. And that was, and he said, and that's the reason. He's like, and he was really weird. He actually was close to tears at one point. And he said that even as he was doing the show that morning, he was aware that doing the show was the reason. It became this weird, like Mobius trip. He said, it was like doing the show was, you know, and talking about his wife getting, you know, divorcing him. It's like that show was the reason that the divorce was even happening. But he obviously is a guy. He's, you know, he'll just stay in there till he dies. Probably. I mean, he'll be one of those guys that just goes out on stage. I mean, because he obviously has no ability to live his life in any other way.
Well, it is very strange. I saw the movie, and there is a section in the movie where he actually sort of illustrates that a bit with, you know, his wife hearing from other people,
right,
about his husband with, you know, the strippers, you know, demonstrating blowjob or whatever it was they were doing,
yeah,
on the show. And that she had just, her just reaching this level of intolerance and inability to deal with hearing from other people these things her husband was doing basically publicly.
Right.
And I remember seeing that movie and thinking at the time, wow, that is strange. That's a strange situation to be in. That must be very, very odd. And in a, obviously not in even remotely a similar sense, but kind of an analog. Now I find, like, I went to Aaron Duran's thing, you know, on Saturday for the launch of his comic, and I meet somebody. I'm a listener. That's great. And they look over and they say, oh, and that must be Patrick. And I'm like, yes, this is Patrick.
Who I've never met and shouldn't know.
Right. And it's like, so hi. And then Patrick shakes the guy's hand,
yeah,
and he's like, hey. And the guy, and I'm just like immediately going through my head of like all of the things I've talked about Patrick,
right,
on,
oh,
the
God,
show.
What have I said?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And every once in a while I'll go home and I'll go, so I was, I said this about you today, so just so you know.
Yeah, Lara has really, fortunately, she's gotten to the point where she, when she and I were first together, she felt really, really compelled to listen to the show every day. You know, and you know, it just, you know, I don't know, for whatever reason, I think. And part of it was just that she wanted to hear if I did say anything about her so that she wouldn't hear it secondhand through somebody else, so that she wouldn't be caught off guard by it. And eventually she kind of got, she became zen enough with it that, like, you know, that she stopped caring. And even when she does have, every now and again, there is one friend of hers in particular who will hear something and just cannot wait, just cannot wait to just get on the phone like a squawking little titmouse, and just call her up and go, well, you know, did you hear what Rick said about you on the air today? And she is at the point where she can sort of let it like roll off and not let it bother her. But it's a weird sort of thing, you know, and it's a strange sort of where you have to get the one that actually she said she had the hardest problem getting past this. The one thing that Lara had the most difficulty with was people coming up to her. And it's like, you know, we would be, I don't know, out or like a party or something, or the, you know, or you know, somebody would occasionally, she'd have a coworker who was a listener who would go like, oh, your husband is that Rick. And they would always do the same thing. They go, so you're Lara and Rick. Oh, Rick Emerson, Lara, you're. And she'd say yes. And they would say, I have to tell you, you are such a patient, tolerant woman. You are a saint. I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you put up with him. And she said that, like, though, that was the thing that bothered her the most, because then she would just go home and go, like, am I a patsy? Am I a fool? Because she would just wonder if, like, if everybody else saw something that she did not see, and that she was just such a sucker for sticking around. The answer is yes, by the way. And that she was just somehow being completely blind to the fact that she ought to just be dumping my ass. And so, so you have that to look forward to at some point.
Well, Patrick and I have had that conversation even before I started doing this, though. We had many conversations in which I would just say, thank you. Thank you for putting up with me. Thank you so much for just tolerating all of this.
Well,
so, and that was before I ever even started doing this. So.
On your second date.
Yeah.
All right. Are we in a watch of some
kind? I was going to say no, but we could do the penis watch. And then while that music is playing, you could go get your cup of coffee.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And then we'll do the penis watch. We'll do the clue for today for the EH vending contest. And then we'll do the top five. And then you will go over and do ham-fisted radio at Cascadia.fm. All right. Look over there.
Take a look at my enormous penis, and my troubles start a melting away. I take a look at my enormous penis, and everything is going my way.
So this would be the penis watch
for Wednesday.
A 21-year-old Georgia man is facing child molestation charges in Columbus, accused of exposing himself inside a Chuck E. Cheese restaurant. A mother told police that the man, whose name was Something McGee, somehow managed to excise his first name somehow.
It just sounds like, never mind, go ahead.
Let's call him Dickie McGee.
I was trying to come up with, like, Tool O'Gee. No, that doesn't work. I realize that I only ever work on the opposite side of that name equation.
Mother told police.
Dickie McGee.
McGee came and sat down at the end of her table. She noticed he had his hands between his legs, but tells police she thought he was texting on his cell phone.
Uh-huh.
When she went to move her purse closer to her, because he was a black man.
I see.
She says she noticed that McGee was masturbating with his penis fully exposed.
Fully exposed.
According to police reports, Chuck E. Cheese's was packed with children and families at the time, and witnesses say McGee was looking around at the kids as he was pleasuring himself.
God damn almighty, that is just the worst thing. And you wonder how often... the Dickie McGee's of the world pick Chuck E. Cheese as the place for their fun outing.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, because it's just... You gotta imagine, you can't, like, if you're out, like, in public, you know, like, at a park or something, I was gonna say there's a greater chance of being seen, but I guess that Chuck E. Cheese is filled with people, but maybe sections of Chuck E. Cheese are filled only with children who maybe because they are not adults and they're not attuned to spotting that kind of thing. Like,
yeah,
they have
busy.
Not yet
they're,
been sort of...
They're running around from machine to machine and running back to the table and grabbing their pizza, and they're not paying attention to what some man is doing under the table.
Yeah.
The mother grabbed her kids and called for help, and McGee took off running. Police say he ran across the road and hid in a fashion trends store. The manager of the Chuck E. Cheese's chased after McGee and waited outside the store until officers got there. He was found in the back and arrested without incident. He's being held in Muskogee County Jail and charged with child molestation and false information because officers said he lied about when he was born, saying he was 16.
Is there a photograph? Does he look 16?
No.
All right.
No.
I would imagine that that's probably not a lie that had a great deal of efficacy when he said it. Okay.
No. He was 21, right. So, you know, he's youngish, but he didn't look 16.
Good God almighty. All right. That's your penis watch for Wednesday right here on the Rick Emerson radio program. There
Take a look at my enormous penis, and my troubles start a-melting away. I take a look at my enormous penis, and everything is going my way.
All right. Let's do one more here, and then we'll do the clue for today. Then we'll do the top five.
Okay. Well, I should do this Geek Watch because we haven't. Right. We keep avoiding it.
Here is your Geek Watch for Wednesday.
Ugh, this high-speed modem is intolerably slow.
In the Quasar Dilemma, remember you used to...
It's just a television show. That's all, okay?
Right, but because we were wondering if the quantum flux... Now, just listen.
There is no quantum flux. There's no auxiliary. There's no goddamn ship. You got it?
Energize.
By the way, he does not look 16.
He does not look 16.
No.
Dickie McGee.
Okay.
Or whatever is his first name, actually. Okay. Kenneth.
That's
actually,
fantastic.
His first name is Kenneth D. McGee, so maybe his middle name is Dickie. Anyway, our Geek Watch. Apple Chief Executive Steve Jobs sent an email to company employees yesterday, I believe it was, informing them that he's taking a medical leave of absence. I will continue as CEO and be involved in major strategic decisions for the company, Jobs wrote. Chief Operating Officer Tim Cook will take over the day-to-day operations. Jobs was sure to note that he hopes to be back as soon as I can, but in the meantime, he would deeply appreciate respect for our privacy. Although Jobs never said specifically why he requested medical leave, he's had health issues in the past. Jobs was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in 2004 and underwent a liver transplant in 2009. TechCrunch, the blog, writes, we may hear more about Jobs' health condition in the future when Apple releases Q4 and 2010 earnings, which I believe was today. They're releasing their earnings statement.
The other thing about this is, you know, he had the pancreatic cancer, and then he had a transplant, and he's never. I mean, and he said at one point that he had recovered. He said that, you know, I'm on the road to recovery. I'm sort of beating this thing, and he was lucky enough to get a transplant, and that, you know, he hoped that he was going to be back at 100%. For whatever reason, he has never really looked as robust as he did before that. Now, you can also make, just as we've seen with Patrick, you can make the argument, I suppose, that just takes a lot out of you. It gives you a little bit of a weathering and an instant aging that never really goes away.
Well, and cancer does age people. I have a friend who had bowel cancer several years ago, and she beat it. I mean, but they had to cut out a hunk of her bowel, and she had to walk around with a colostomy bag for a while, and she did beat the cancer. But it did add a few years of age to her. She looked probably a good 5 years older after she beat the cancer than she did before.
It's interesting too that if you look at Apple, the big question over the last couple of days has been, what is the stock going to do, and how is the market going to react to the news of Jobs stepping down? Because that's the double-edged sword of having such a cult of personality. And of having, wrongly.
Apparently, the Apple stock in Germany plunged like 7%.
Yeah.
As soon as he made the announcement.
Which is, and you got to give it to Bill Gates, because Gates realized, I mean, I know this is, I'm not saying this is the reason he did it, but Gates realized that if he had something like that happen to him at a certain point, Microsoft would have just imploded, probably their value. I mean, it would have taken a huge hit, at least. Not even because Bill Gates was the guy who was, driving the car, but just because there's the perception of it. Because, I mean, look, don't get me wrong. I love Steve Jobs. I really do. I love Steve Jobs the same way I love Bill Gates. I love him the same way I love Larry Ellison. A lot of those guys who were sort of, and that it's not just in the computer world. I admire anybody who I really have an unabashed love of guys who are good at business and marketing and the creation of products and the packaging of products and and that's everybody from Henry Ford to Lee Iacocca to Steve Jobs. So I really do love Steve Jobs, but the idea that he is the sole guiding force behind everything that Apple does that's great, that is one of the great, I think, sort of pop business myths of our time, because he obviously is the ultimate decision maker, but he is also surrounded by people who really, really know what they're doing. I mean, it's sort of like giving Jobs sole credit for, everything great on the iPhone is a little bit like giving him credit, for Toy Story 2. It doesn't. He's obviously the guy who shepherds a lot of those things along, but he obviously has a design team, and his lead designer's name is escaping me at the moment. But he has a design team really that is second to none. He is able to inspire people, and he is able to be a great figurehead for the company when he's not actively involved in design. But he's not necessarily doing all of that. But you see the downside of having such a cult of personality, that the market and the general public react as though like the end is nigh.
Well, that's been the belief system in politics for a long, long time, that the leader of a country must seem robust and healthy to the point where sometimes they'll fake it if he's not.
Kim Jong-il in a basement.
The questions about whether or not, Reagan was actually shot when he was shot, or whether he had a heart attack when they shoved him into the car.
Right.
And those questions are really valid because, he looks a lot stronger and more like the cowboy they want you to believe he is if he got shot and then survived a bullet wound than the fact that he's a 71-year-old man who was terrified when they shoved him into a car and he had a heart attack.
Right. Well, there's actually a new book. Ron Reagan has a book out this week where he says he claims, and it should be said without medical evidence, but he claims that his dad had Alzheimer's while he was in office. And there's been a lot of, heated debate about that. And, obviously you don't want a president who has Alzheimer's for any number of reasons. But among them is the very real symbolic importance of a leader. And so I think Gates at some point realized he couldn't put all his eggs in that basket because Microsoft's public valuation and their forward momentum might have been stalled or delayed a little bit. So he, you know, Gates is still with Microsoft, but he delegated, you know, his day-to-day responsibilities. And, you know, I think he had like a sort of triumvirate of people who kind of came in and took over for him. So it'll be interesting to see if Jobs actually comes back. I mean, I think that we all know that even if he wasn't going to come back, even if he was stepping down for good, he wouldn't say so now because he knows that the effect, again, on Apple morale and stock. And I actually was in Beaverton the other day and I had an appointment, but I had a few minutes to kill. So, of course, like a patsy, I just walk into the Apple store because it's right there. And I didn't buy anything, but I was just sort of wandering around, just looking at, just touching all of the pretty tchotchkes. And in the Apple store, it was like sort of, it was like a weird revisitation of the Stern thing. Like in the Apple store, it was kind of what everybody was talking about. And it's not like it had affected them that day. It's not like anything was, it's not like the store was going to catch on fire. You know, Steve's not here. Then the walls of the temple collapse. But it was all anything what anybody was talking about. What makes it even better or worse for Jobs is that it's one thing if he had just left Apple, you know, and then they had to weather that. It's that he left Apple, everything went in the toilet. He came back to Apple after being at Next and being sort of exiled in the wilderness in the post-Scully era. You know, he came back to Apple and sort of resurrected the company. And so you do that once, people go, hey, he's great. You do it twice and they go, and if you do it twice the way he did with the iPhone and the iPod and Pixar, people go, My God, he touched the hem of my garment and I was healed. And, you know, and anyway, so, well, I wish him a speedy recovery and whatever, but it's one of those things that you almost hope that he has an exit strategy in mind right now so that it doesn't just sort of send shockwaves through not just Apple and not just through Apple fanboys, but through like the American economy and through, you know, American economy as it exists in the rest of the world. Because, you know, Apple makes a huge amount of their money from overseas, and that money comes right back to the U.S. So, well, in any event, there's your Geek Watch for Wednesday.
By Grefthar's hammer, by the sons of Warvan, I shall avenge you.
Next. Ooh, loneliness and cheeseburgers are a dangerous mix.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's come time to do the clue for today's E.H. Vending contest. The E.H. Vending contest for today. Clue. This is clue the second. So, as we mentioned earlier, we did the clue on Monday. We did the clue today, or we will be doing
we
it.
Will
we didn't
be.
So much do it yesterday. Yesterday is the day where we didn't do the clue. We talked about it. We did the setup. We did the open, and then we completely failed to do it. So we're going to give out Tuesday's clue today. So, of course, as we've been saying, as we get to the end of the week, normally it'll be 5. This week it's going to be 4. When you get to Friday, we're going to give out another question. I keep saying clue, but we're going to give out a question on Friday. Once we have given out the question on Friday, the first person to correctly answer all of those questions via email to snack@rickemerson.com will win a basket of delightful and consumable wondrous gifts from ehvending.com. You can find them at ehvending.com. That's ehvending.com. That is their website. And if you want to call them, you can do that as well. They have myriad ways in which you can contact them. You can call Josh, who is the owner, at 360-816-1853. Or you can call James, the sales manager, at 503-897-8204. So if you are unhappy with your current vendor, the person who's providing or stocking your machines, or if you just have never done that before, you need a coffee service, you need one of those refrigerators in which you keep your soda, your whatnot at your business, or if you're just frankly too lazy to get off the sofa and you want something there next to the ottoman into which you can reach for an Idaho Spud now and again, you contact EH Vending at ehvending.com. And again, you can call them at 360-816-1853, or you can call James 503-897-8204. And they deal with a lot of smaller companies as clients as well. They've picked up accounts that were turned away from other vendors because the company was too small. And so they will find something that works for you. So again, we give out one question every weekday. And at the end of the week, on Friday, when we give out Friday's question, the first person who can correctly answer all of them via email at snack@rickemerson.com.
All 4 of them.
This week it's 4. It'll typically be 5. I'm just saying, we're gonna try to hoe the hoe. Whatever. Next week, we're gonna try to hew to a more accurate and correct number of questions given out. This week, it's gonna be 4, though. Today's question is this. This is today's question. In what American city In what American city? And I, of course, am not indicating anything untoward about E.H. vending when I say this. In what American city can you find marijuana vending machines? In what American city can you find marijuana vending machines? So that is question number two for this week. Most weeks will be five. This week is going to be four. That is today's question, Wednesday's question. So we gave out a question on Monday. Today, we just did one. Thursday and then Friday. Once Friday's is given out, the first person to answer all four of those questions at snack@rickemerson.com will win that collection of consumable goodness from the bosom of EH Vending. Things that they are holding in their hands, waiting to give them to the listener who correctly susses out the answer to these four queries.
The greasy, crunchy, sugary things that they're clutching to their collective bosom.
It's not a greasy bosom, though. It's a wondrous bosom, Don.
Because all of the greasy, delicious, snacky things are in packages.
When did we lose the ability to speak today?
When did that happen? That started early for me, really.
All right. Yeah. So there you go. That is today's question. In what American city can you find marijuana vending machines? There you go. That is today's question. Again, don't answer today. You wait till Friday when we give out Friday's question. You answer all four questions quickly. snack@rickemerson.com. The first person to do so on Friday will win that prize. That is ehvending.com. ehvending.com. So now, regrettably, we're not going to have time to do the top five. We'll have to do the top five tomorrow because, Don Taylor, you are headed over to do Ham-Fisted Radio at Cascadia.fm. You can hear that at 4 p.m. Pacific time today, co-hosted by Mr. Bobby Fatboy Roberts, and you can get it later on, downloadable at HamFistedRadio.com. Join us tomorrow when our guests will include Anna Griffin from The Oregonian. Friday, Mr. Big Jim Willig will be in the studio. Friday, Big Jim Willig here with another installment of Humor Me, Comedy 101. Friday's subject is going to be Jon Stewart. That's coming up this Friday. We want to thank today's guests, including Kelly Clark from Willamette Week, the new issue on stands now, reader in print, and Willamette Week are online at WWeek.com. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milk packing district here in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, Don Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Sagal, chief of staff Cheryl Kanakoa. The Rick Emerson Show made possible by a generous grant from you all. It is Wednesday, January 19th, and that is The Frequency. Kenneth, as always, thank you for listening. Be safe. See you all tomorrow. Bye now.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.